have anything on inside out. I looked at her, startled. She looked back with a kind of cynical good humor. It wasn't an expression that looked particularly at home on her face. I may only be 20, but I'm not stupid, she said. He's watching me. I know it, and you probably do, too. On another night, I might be tempted to say fuck him if he can't take a joke, but it's cooler out there, and the smoke from the hibachi will keep the worst of the bugs away. Have I shocked you? If so, I'm sorry. You haven't. She had, a little. No need to apologize. We carried our drinks down the not-quite-steady cinder block steps and sat side by side in a couple of lawn chairs. To the left of us, the coals in the hibachi glowed soft rose in the growing gloom. Maddie leaned back, placed the cold curve of her glass briefly against her forehead, then drank most of what was left, the ice cubes sliding against her teeth with a click and a rattle. Crickets hummed in the woods behind the trailer and across the road. Further up Highway 68, I could see the bright white fluorescence over the gas island at the Lakeview General. The seat of my chair was a little baggy, the interwoven straps a little frayed, and the old girl canted pretty severely to the left, but there was still no place I'd rather have been sitting just then. This evening it turned out to be a quiet little miracle. At least, so far, we still had John Starro to get to. I'm glad you came on a Tuesday, she said. Tuesday nights are hard for me. I'm always thinking of the ball game down at Warrington's. The guys will be picking up the gear by now, the bats and bases and catcher's mask, and putting it back in the storage cabinet behind home plate, drinking their last beers and smoking their last cigarettes. That's where I met my husband, you know. I'm sure you've been told all that by now. I couldn't see her face clearly, but I could hear the faint tinge of bitterness which had crept into her voice, and guessed she was still wearing the cynical expression. It was too old for her, but I thought she'd come by it honestly enough. Although, if she didn't watch out, it would take root and grow. I heard a version from Bill, yes, Lindy's brother-in-law. Oh, yeah, our story's on retail. You can get it at the store, or the village cafe, or at that old blabbermouth's garage, which my father-in-law rescued from Western Savings, by the way. He stepped in just before the bank could foreclose. Now Dickie Brooks and his cronies think Max DeVore is walking, talking Jesus. I hope you got a fairer version from Mr. Dean than you'd get at the all-purpose. You must have, or you wouldn't have risked eating hamburgers with Jezebel. I wanted to get away from that if I could. Her anger was understandable but useless. Of course, it was easier for me to see that. It wasn't my kid who had been turned into the handkerchief tied at the center of a tug-of-war rope. They still play softball at Warrington's, even though DeVore bought the place? Oh, yes, indeed. He goes down to the field in his motorized wheelchair every Tuesday evening and watches. There are other things he's done since he came back here that are just attempts to buy the town's good opinion, but I think he genuinely loves the softball games. The Whitmore woman goes, too. Brings an extra oxygen tank along in a little red wheelbarrow with a white wall tire on the front. She keeps a fielder's mitt in there, too, in case any foul pops come up over the backstop to where he sits. He caught one near the start of the season, I heard, and got a standing O from the players and the folks who come to watch. Going to the games puts him in touch with his son, you think? Maddie smiled grimly. I don't think Lance so much as crosses his mind, not when he's at the ball field. They play hard at Warrington's, slide into home with their feet up, jump into the pucker brush for the fly balls, curse each other when they do something wrong, and that's what old Max DeVore enjoys. That's why he never misses a Tuesday evening game. He likes to watch them slide and get up bleeding. Is that how Lance played? She thought about it carefully. He played hard, but he wasn't crazed. He was there just for the fun of it. We all were. We women, shit, really just us girls. Barney Terrio's wife Cindy was only 16. We'd stand behind the backstop on the first base side, smoking cigarettes or waving punks to keep the bugs away, cheering our guys when they did something good, laughing when they did something stupid. We'd swap sodas or share a can of beer. I'd admire Helen Geary's twins, and she'd kiss Kai under the chin until Kai giggled. Sometimes we'd go down to the village cafe afterwards, and Buddy'd make us pizzas, losers pay. All friends again, you know, after the game. We'd sit there laughing and yelling and blowing straw wrappers around, some of the guys half-loaded, but nobody mean. In those days, they got all the mean out on the ball field. And you know what? None of them come to see me. Not Helen Geary, who was my best friend. Not Richie Lattimore, who was Lance's best friend. The two of them would talk about rocks and birds and the kind of trees that were across the lake for hours on end. They came to the funeral, and for a little while after, and then... You know what it was like? When I was a kid, our well dried up. For a while you'd get a trickle when you turned on the tap, but then there was just air. Just air. The cynicism was gone, and there was only hurt in her voice. I saw Helen at Christmas, and we promised to get together for the twins' birthday, but we never did. I think she's scared to come near me. Because of the old man? Who else? But that's okay. Life goes on. She sat up, drank the rest of her Kool-Aid, and set the glass aside. What about you, Mike? Did you come back to write a book? Are you going to name the TR? This was a local bon mot that I remembered with an almost painful twinge of nostalgia. Locals with great plans were said to be bent on naming the TR. No, I said, and then astonished myself by saying, I don't do that anymore. I think I expected her to leap to her feet, overturning her chair and uttering a sharp cry of horrified denial. All of which says a good deal about me, I suppose, and none of it flattering. You've retired? She asked, sounding calm and remarkably unhorrified. Or is it writer's block? Well, it's certainly not chosen retirement. I realized the conversation had taken a rather amusing turn. I'd come primarily to sell her on John Storrow, to shove John Storrow down her throat, if that was what it took. And instead, I was for the first time discussing my inability to work, for the first time with anyone. So it's a block. I used to think so, but now I'm not so sure. I think novelists may come equipped with a certain number of stories to tell. They're built into the software. And when they're gone, they're gone. I doubt that, she said. Maybe you'll write now that you're down here. Maybe that's part of the reason you came back. Maybe you're right. Are you scared? Sometimes. Mostly about what I'll do for the rest of my life. I'm no good at boats and bottles, and my wife was the one with the green thumb. I'm scared, too, she said. Scared a lot. All the time now, it seems like. That he'll win his custody case? Maddie, that's what I... The custody case is only part of it, she said. I'm scared just to be here, on the TR. It started early this summer, long after I knew DeVore meant to get Kai away from me if he could. And it's getting worse. In a way, it's like watching thunderheads gather over New Hampshire and then come piling across the lake. I can't put it any better than that, except... She shifted, crossing her legs and then bending forward to pull the skirt of her dress against the line of her shin, as if she were cold. Except that I've woken up several times lately... Sure that I wasn't in the bedroom alone. Once when I was sure I wasn't in the bed alone. Sometimes it's just a feeling, like a headache only in your nerves, and sometimes I think I can hear whispering or crying. I made a cake one night, about 2 weeks ago this was, and forgot to put the flour away. The next morning the canister was overturned, and the flour was spilled on the counter. Someone had written "Hello" in it. I thought at first it was Kai, but she said she didn't do it. Besides, it wasn't her printing. Hers is all straggly. I don't know if she could even write hello. Hi, maybe, but... Mike, you don't think he could be sending someone around to try and freak me out, do you? I mean, that's just stupid, right? I don't know, I said. I thought of something thumping the insulation in the dark as I stood on the stairs. I thought of hello printed in magnets on my refrigerator door, and a child sobbing in the dark. My skin felt more than cold. It felt numb. A headache in the nerves, that was good. That was exactly how you felt when something reached around the wall of the real world and touched you on the nape of the neck. "Maybe it's ghosts," she said, and smiled in an uncertain way that was more frightened than amused. I opened my mouth to tell her about what had been happening at Sarah Laughs, then closed it again. There was a clear choice to be made here. Either we could be sidetracked into a discussion of the paranormal, or we could come back to the visible world, the one where Max DeVore was trying to steal himself a kid. "Yeah," I said. "Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny, the spirits are about to speak. I wish I could see your face better. There was something on it just then." "What?" "I don't know," I said, "but right now I think we'd better talk about Kyra, okay?" "Okay." In the faint glow of the hibachi, I could see her settling herself in her chair as if to take a blow. "I've been subpoenaed to give a deposition in Castle Rock on Friday, before Elmer Durgan, who's Kyra's guardian ad litem." "That pompous little toad isn't Kai's anything," she burst out. "He's in my father-in-law's hip pocket, just like Dickie Osgood, old Max's pet realtor. Dickie and Elmer Durgan drink together down at the Mellow Tiger, or at least they did until this business really got going. Then someone probably told them it would look bad, and they stopped." The papers were served by a deputy named George Footman. "Just one more of the usual suspects," Maddie said in a thin voice. "Dickie Osgood's a snake, but George Footman's a junkyard dog. He's been suspended off the cops twice. Once more, and he can work for Max DeVore full time." "Well, he scared me. I tried not to show it, but he did. And people who scare me make me angry. I called my agent in New York and then hired a lawyer, one who makes a specialty of child custody cases." I tried to see how she was taking this and couldn't, although we were sitting fairly close together. But she still had that set look, like a woman who expects to take some hard blows. Or perhaps for Maddie, the blows had already started to fall. Slowly, not allowing myself to rush, I went through my conversation with John Storrow. I emphasized what Storrow had said about sexual equality, that it was apt to be a negative force in her case, making it easier for Judge Rancourt to take Kyra away. I also came down hard on the fact that DeVore could have all the lawyers he wanted, not to mention sympathetic witnesses with Richard Osgood running around the TR and spreading DeVore's dough, but that the court wasn't obligated to treat her to so much as an ice cream cone. I finished by telling her that John wanted to talk to one of us tomorrow at 11, and that it should be her. Then I waited. The silence spun out, broken only by crickets and the faint revving of some kid's unmuffled truck. Up Route 68, the white fluorescence went out as the Lakeview Market finished another day of summer trade. I didn't like Maddie's quiet. It seemed like the prelude to an explosion, a Yankee explosion. I held my peace and waited for her to ask me what gave me the right to meddle in her business. When she finally spoke, her voice was low and defeated. It hurt to hear her sounding that way, but like the cynical look on her face earlier, it wasn't surprising. And I hardened myself against it as best I could. "Hey, Maddie, tough old world. Pick one." "Why would you do this?" she asked. "Why would you hire an expensive New York lawyer to take my case? That is what you're offering, isn't it? It's got to be because I sure can't hire him. I got $30,000 insurance money when Lance died and was lucky to get that. It was a policy he bought from one of his Warrington's friends, almost as a joke. But without it, I would have lost the trailer last winter. They may love Dickie Brooks at Western Savings, but they don't give a rat's ass for Maddie Stanchfield DeVore. After taxes, I make about $100 a week at the library. So you're offering to pay, right?"
"Right."
"Why? You don't even know us."
"Because..."
I trailed off. I seem to remember wanting Joe to step in at that point, asking my mind to supply her voice, which I could then pass on to Maddie and my own. But Joe didn't come. I was flying solo. "Because... now I do nothing that makes a difference. I said at last, and once again the words astonished me. And I do know you. I've eaten your food. I've read Kai a story and had her fall asleep in my lap. And maybe I saved her life the other day when I grabbed her out of the road. We'll never know for sure, but maybe I did. You know what the Chinese say about something like that? I didn't expect an answer. The question was more rhetorical than real. But she surprised me. Not for the last time, either. That if you save someone's life, you're responsible for them. Yes, it's also about what's fair and what's right. But I think mostly it's about wanting to be a part of something where I make a difference. I look back on the 4 years since my wife died, and there's nothing there. Not even a book where Marjorie the Shy Typist meets a handsome stranger. She sat thinking this over, watching as a fully loaded pulp truck snored past on the highway, its headlights glaring and its load of logs swaying from side to side like the hips of an overweight woman. "Don't you root for us," she said at last. She spoke in a low, unexpectedly fierce voice. "Don't you root for us like he roots for his team of the week down at the softball field. I need help, and I know it, but I won't have that. I can't have it. We're not a game, Kai and me. You understand?" "Perfectly." "You know what people in town will say, don't you?"
"Yes."
"I'm a lucky girl, don't you think? First I marry the son of an extremely rich man, and after he dies, I fall under the protective wing of another rich guy. Next, I'll probably move in with Donald Trump."
"Cut it out."
"I'd probably believe it myself if I were on the other side. But I wonder if anyone notices that Lucky Maddie is still living in a Maud Air trailer and can't afford health insurance, or that her kid got most of her vaccinations from the county nurse. My parents died when I was 15. I have a brother and a sister, but they're both a lot older and both out of state. My parents were drunks. Not physically abusive, but there was plenty of the other kinds. It was like growing up in a roach motel. My dad was a pulper. My mom was a bourbon beautician whose one ambition was to own a Mary Kay pink Cadillac. He drowned in Keewaydin Pond. She drowned in her own vomit about 6 months later. How do you like it so far?"
"Not very much. I'm sorry."
"After Mom's funeral, my brother Hugh offered to take me back to Rhode Island, but I could tell his wife wasn't exactly nuts about having a 15-year-old join the family, and I can't say I blamed her. Also, I just made the JV cheering squad. That seems like supreme diddly shit now, but it was a very big deal then."
Of course it had been a big deal, especially to the child of alcoholics, the only one still living at home. Being that last child, watching as the disease really digs its claws in, can be one of the world's loneliest jobs. Last one out of the sacred gin mill, please turn off the lights.
I ended up going to live with my Aunt Florence, just 2 miles down the road. It took us about 3 weeks to discover we didn't like each other very much, but we made it work for 2 years. Then, between my junior and senior year, I got a summer job at Warrington's and met Lance. When he asked me to marry him, Aunt Flo refused to give permission. When I told her I was pregnant, she emancipated me so I didn't need it.
"You dropped out of school?"
She grimaced, nodded. I didn't want to spend 6 months having people watch me swell up like a balloon. Lance supported me. He said I could take the equivalency test. I did last year. It was easy. And now, Kai and I are on our own. Even if my aunt agreed to help me, what could she do? She works in the Castle Rock Gore-Tex factory and makes about $16,000 a year. I nodded again, thinking that my last check for French royalties had been about that. My last quarterly check. Then I remembered something Kai had told me on the day I met her. When I was carrying Kyra out of the road, she said that if you were mad, she'd go to her white nana. If your folks are dead, who did she... Except I didn't really have to ask. I only had to make one or two simple connections. Rogette Whitmore's the white nana, divorce assistant. But that means that Kai's been with them. Yes, you bet. Until late last month, I allowed her to visit her grandpa, and Rogette by association, of course, quite often. Once or twice a week, and sometimes for an overnight.
She likes her white papa, at least she did at first, and she absolutely adores that creepy woman. I thought Maddie shivered in the gloom, although the night was still very warm. DeVore called to say he was coming east for Lance's funeral and to ask if he could see his granddaughter while he was here. Nice as pie he was, just as if he'd never tried to buy me off when Lance told him we were going to get married.
Did he?
Uh-huh. The first offer was $100,000. That was in August of 1994, after Lance called him to say we were getting married in mid-September. I kept quiet about it. A week later, the offer went up to $200,000.
For what, precisely?
To remove my bitch hooks and relocate with no forwarding address. This time I did tell Lance, and he hit the roof, called his old man and said we were going to be married whether he liked it or not. Told him that if he ever wanted to see his grandchild, he had better cut the shit and behave. With another parent, I thought, that was probably the most reasonable response Lance DeVore could have made. I respected him for it. The only problem was that he wasn't dealing with a reasonable man. He was dealing with a fellow who, as a child, had stolen Scooter Larrabee's new sled. These offers were made by DeVore himself, over the telephone, both when Lance wasn't around. Then, about 10 days before the wedding, I had a visit from Dickie Osgood. I was to make a call to a number in Delaware, and when I did... Maddie shook her head. You wouldn't believe it. It's like something out of one of your books.
May I guess?
If you want. He tried to buy the child. He tried to buy Kyra. Her eyes widened. A scantling moon had come up, and I could see that look of surprise well enough. How much? I asked. I'm curious. How much for you to give birth, leave DeVore's granddaughter with Lance, then scat?
$2 million, she whispered. Deposited in the bank of my choice, as long as it was west of the Mississippi, and I signed an agreement to stay away from her, and from Lance, until at least March 20th, 2016.
The year Kai turns 21.
Yes.
And Osgood doesn't know any of the details, so DeVore's skirts remain clean here in town.
Uh-huh. And the $2 million was only the start. There was to be an additional million on Kai's 5th, 10th, 15th, and 20th birthdays.
She shook her head in a disbelieving way.
The linoleum keeps bubbling up in the kitchen, the showerhead keeps falling into the tub, and the whole damn rig cants to the east these days, but I could have been the $6 million woman.
Did you ever consider taking the offer, Maddie? I wondered. But that was a question I'd never ask. Curiosity so unseemly it deserved no satisfaction.
Did you tell Lance?
I tried not to. He was already furious with his father, and I didn't want to make it worse. I didn't want that much hate at the start of our marriage, no matter how good the reasons for hating might be. And I didn't want Lance to... later on with me, you know.
She raised her hands, then dropped them back on her thighs. The gesture was both weary and oddly endearing.
You didn't want Lance turning on you 10 years later and saying, you came between me and my father, you bitch.
Something like that. But in the end, I couldn't keep it to myself. I was just this kid from the sticks, didn't own a pair of pantyhose until I was 11, wore my hair in nothing but braids or a ponytail until I was 13, thought the whole state of New York was New York City. And this guy, this... phantom father had offered me $6 million. It terrified me. I had dreams about him coming in the night like a troll and stealing my baby out of her crib. He'd come wriggling through the window like a snake,
dragging his oxygen tank behind him, no doubt.
She smiled. I didn't know about the oxygen then, or Rogette Whitmore either. All I'm trying to say is that I was 18 and not good at keeping secrets.
I had to restrain my own smile at the way she said this, as if decades of experience now lay between that naive, frightened child and this mature woman with the mail-order diploma.
Lance was angry.
So angry he replied to his father by email instead of calling. He stuttered, you see, and the more upset he was, the worse his stutter became. A phone conversation would have been impossible. Now, At last, I thought I had a clear picture. Lance DeVore had written his father an unthinkable letter. Unthinkable that was if you happened to be Max DeVore. The letter said that Lance didn't want to hear from his father again, and Maddie didn't either. He wouldn't be welcome in their home. The Maud Air trailer wasn't quite the humble woodcutter's cottage of a Brothers Grimm tale, but it was close enough for kissing. He wouldn't be welcome to visit following the birth of their child, and if he had the gall to send the child a present then or later, it would be returned. Stay out of my life, Dad. This time you've gone too far to forgive. There are undoubtedly diplomatic ways of handling an offended child, some wise and some crafty. But ask yourself this. Would a diplomatic father have gotten himself into such a situation to begin with? Would a man with even minimal insight into human nature have offered his son's fiancée a bounty, one so enormous it probably had little real sense or meaning to her, to give up her firstborn child? And he'd offered this devil's bargain to a girl woman of 18, an age when the romantic view of life is at absolute high tide. If nothing else, DeVore should have waited a while before making his final offer. You could argue that he didn't know he had a while, but it wasn't a persuasive argument. I thought Maddie was right. Deep in that wrinkled old prune which served him as a heart, Max DeVore thought he was going to live forever. In the end, he hadn't been able to restrain himself. There was the sled he wanted, the sled he just had to have, on the other side of the window. All he had to do was break the glass and take it. He'd been doing it all his life, and so he had reacted to his son's email not craftily, as a man of his years and ability should have done, but furiously, as the child would have done if the glass in the shed window had proved immune to his hammering fists. Lance didn't want him meddling? Fine. Lance could live with his backwoods Daisy May in a tent or a trailer or a goddamn cow barn. He could give up the cushy surveying job as well and find real employment. See how the other half lived. In other words, you can't quit on me, son. You're fired. We didn't fall into each other's arms at the funeral, Maddie said. Don't get that idea. But he was decent to me, which I didn't expect. And I tried to be decent to him. He offered me a stipend, which I refused. I was afraid there might be legal ramifications. I doubt it, but I like your caution. What happened when he saw Kyra for the first time, Maddie? Do you remember? I'll never forget it. She reached into the pocket of her dress, found a battered pack of cigarettes, and shook one out. She looked at it with a mixture of greed and disgust. I quit these because Lance said we couldn't really afford them, and I knew he was right. But the habit creeps back. I only smoke a pack a week, and I know damned well even that's too much, but sometimes I need the comfort. Do you want one? I shook my head. She lit up, and in the momentary flare of the match, her face was way past pretty. What had the old man made of her, I wondered. He met his granddaughter for the first time beside a hearse, Maddie said. We were at Dakin's funeral home in Monton. It was the viewing. Do you know about that? Oh, yes, I said, thinking of Joe. The casket was closed, but they still call it a viewing. Weird. I came out to have a cigarette. I told Kai to sit on the funeral parlor steps so she wouldn't get the smoke, and I went a little way down the walk. This big gray limo pulled up. I'd never seen anything like it before, except on TV. I knew who it was right away. I put my cigarettes back in my purse and told Kai to come. She toddled down the walk and took hold of my hand. The limo door opened and Rogette Whitmore got out. She had an oxygen mask in one hand, but he didn't need it, at least not then. He got out after her, a tall man, not as tall as you, Mike, but tall, wearing a gray suit and black shoes as shiny as mirrors. She paused, thinking. Her cigarette rose briefly to her mouth, then went back down to the arm of her chair, a red firefly in the weak moonlight. At first he didn't say anything. The woman tried to take his arm and help him climb the 3 or 4 steps from the road to the walk, but he shook her off. He got to where we were standing under his own power, although I could hear him wheezing way down deep in his chest.
It was the sound a machine makes when it needs oil. I don't know how much he can walk now, but it's probably not much. Those few steps pretty well did him in, and that was almost a year ago. He looked at me for a second or two, then bent forward with his big, bony old hands on his knees. He looked at Kyra, and she looked up at him. Yes, I could see it. Except not in color, not in an image like a photograph. I saw it as a woodcut, just one more harsh illustration from Grimm's fairy tales. The little girl looks up wide-eyed at the rich old man, once a boy who went triumphantly sliding on a stolen sled, now at the other end of his life in just one more bag of bones. In my imagining, Kai was wearing a hooded jacket, and Devore's grandpa mask was slightly askew, allowing me to see the tufted wolf pelt beneath. What big eyes you have, Grandpa. What a big nose you have, Grandpa. What big teeth you have, too. He picked her up. I don't know how much effort it cost him, but he did. And the oddest thing, Kai let herself be picked up. He was a complete stranger to her, and old people always seemed to scare little children, but she let him pick her up. "Do you know who I am?" he asked her. She shook her head, but the way she was looking at him, it was as if she almost knew. "Do you think that's possible?"
"Yes."
He said, "I'm your grandpa." And I almost grabbed her back, Mike, because I had this crazy idea, I don't know,
that he was going to eat her up.
Her cigarette paused in front of her mouth. Her eyes were round. "How do you know that? How can you know that?"
"Because in my mind's eye, it looks like a fairy tale. Little Red Riding Hood and the old gray wolf.
What did he do then?" "Ate her up with his eyes. Since then, he's taught her to play checkers and Candyland and box dots. She's only three, but he's taught her to add and subtract. She has her own room at Warrington's and her own little computer in it, and God knows what he's taught her to do with that. But that first time, he only looked at her. It was the hungriest look I've ever seen in my life. And she looked back. It couldn't have been more than 10 or 20 seconds, but it seemed like forever. Then he tried to hand her back to me. He'd used up all his strength, though, and if I hadn't been right there to take her, I think he would have dropped her on the cement walk. He staggered a little, and Roget Whitmore put an arm around him. That was when he took the oxygen mask from her. There was a little red air bottle attached to it on an elastic, and put it over his mouth and nose. A couple of deep breaths, and he seemed more or less all right again. He gave it back to Roget and really seemed to see me for the first time. He said, "I've been a fool, haven't I?" I said, "Yes, sir, I think you have." He gave me a look, very black, when I said that. I think if he'd been even 5 years younger, he might have hit me for it.
But he wasn't, and he didn't.
"No," he said,
"I want to go inside. Will you help me do that?"
I said I would. We went up the mortuary steps with Roget on one side of him, me on the other, and Kyra walking along behind. I felt sort of like a harem girl. It wasn't a very nice feeling. When we got in the vestibule, he sat down to catch his breath and take a little more oxygen. Roget turned to Kyra. "I think that woman's got a scary face. It reminds me of some painting or other."
"The Scream? The one by Munch?"
"I'm pretty sure that's the one."
She dropped her cigarette. She'd smoked it all the way down to the filter and stepped on it, grinding it into the bony, rock-riddled ground with one white sneaker.
But Kai wasn't scared of her a bit. Not then, not later. She bent down to Kyra and said, "What rhymes with lady?" And Kyra said, "Shady," right off. Even at 2, she loved rhymes. Roget reached into her purse and brought out a Hershey's Kiss. Kai looked at me to see if she had permission, and I said, "All right, but just one, and I don't want to see any of it on your dress." Kai popped it into her mouth and smiled at Roget as if they'd been friends since forever. By then, Devore had his breath back, but he looked tired, the most tired man I've ever seen. He reminded me of something in the Bible, about how, in the days of our old age, we say we have no pleasure in them. My heart kind of broke for him. Maybe he saw it because he reached for my hand. He said, Don't shut me out. And at that moment, I could see Lance in his face. I started to cry. I said, I won't unless you make me. I could see them there in the funeral home's foyer. Him sitting, her standing, the little girl looking on in wide-eyed puzzlement as she sucked the sweet Hershey's kiss. Canned organ music in the background. Poor old Max DeVore had been crafty enough on the day of his son's viewing, I thought. Don't shut me out, indeed. I tried to buy you off, and when that didn't work, I upped the stakes and tried to buy the baby. When that also failed, I told my son that you and he and my grandchild could choke on the dirt of your own decision. In a way, I'm the reason he was where he was when he fell and broke his neck, but don't shut me out, Maddie. I'm just a poor old geezer, so don't shut me out. I was stupid, wasn't I? You expected him to be better than he was. If that makes you stupid, Maddie, the world could use more of it. I did have my doubts, she said. It's why I wouldn't take any of his money, and by last October he'd quit asking. But I let him see her. I suppose, yeah, part of it was the idea there might be something in it for Kai later on. But I honestly didn't think about that so much. Mostly it was him being her only blood link to her father. I wanted her to enjoy that the way any kid enjoys having a grandparent. What I didn't want was for her to be infected by all the crap that went on before Lance died. At first it seemed to be working. Then, little by little, things changed. I realized that Kai didn't like her white papa so much, for one thing. Her feelings about Rogetta the same, but Max's divorce started to make her nervous in some way I don't understand and she can't explain. I asked her once if he'd ever touched her anywhere that made her feel funny. I showed her the places I meant, and she said no. I believe her, but he said something or did something. I'm almost sure of it. Could be no more than the sound of his breathing getting worse, I said. That alone might be enough to scare a child. Or maybe he had some kind of spell while she was there. What about you, Maddie? Well, one day in February, Lindy Briggs told me that George Footman had been in to check the fire extinguishers and the smoke detectors in the library. He also asked if Lindy had found any beer cans or liquor bottles in the trash lately, or cigarette butts that were obviously homemade. Roaches, in other words. Uh-huh. And Dickie Osgood has been visiting my old friends, I hear. Chatting. Panning for gold. Digging the dirt. Is there any to dig? Not much, thank God. I hoped she was right, and I hoped that if there was stuff she wasn't telling me, John Storrow would get it out of her. But through all this, you let Kai go on seeing him. What would pulling the plug on the visits have accomplished? And I thought that allowing them to go on would at least keep him from speeding up any plans he might have. That, I thought, made a lonely kind of sense. Then, in the spring, I started to get some extremely creepy, scary feelings. Creepy how? Scary how? I don't know. She took out her cigarettes, looked at them, then stuffed the pack back in her pocket. It wasn't just that my father-in-law was looking for dirty laundry in my closets, either. It was Kai. I started to worry about Kai all the time she was with him. With them. Rogette would come in the BMW they'd bought or leased, and Kai would be sitting out on the steps waiting for her, with her bag of toys if it was a day visit, with her little pink Minnie Mouse suitcase if it was an overnight. And she'd always come back with one more thing than she left with. My father-in-law's a great believer in presents. Before popping her into the car, Rogette would give me that cold little smile of hers and say, 7 o'clock, then, we'll give her supper. Or, 8 o'clock, then, and a nice hot breakfast before she leaves. I'd say okay, and then Rogette would reach into her bag and hold out a Hershey's kiss to Kai just the way you'd hold a biscuit out to a dog to make it shake hands. She'd say a word, and Kyra would rhyme it. Rogette would toss her treat. Woof, woof. Good dog, I always used to think. And off they'd go. Come 7 in the evening or 8 in the morning, the BMW would pull in right where your car's parked now. You could set your clock by the woman. But I got worried. That they might get tired of the legal process and just snatch her?
This seemed to me a reasonable concern, so reasonable I could hardly believe Maddie had ever let her little girl go to the old man in the first place. In custody cases, as in the rest of life, possession tends to be 9/10 of the law, and if Maddie was telling the truth about her past and present, a custody hearing was apt to turn into a tiresome production even for the rich Mr. DeVore. Snatching might, in the end, look like a more efficient solution.
"Not exactly," she said. "I guess it's the logical thing, but that wasn't really it. I just got afraid. There was nothing I could put my finger on. It would get to be 6:15 in the evening, and I'd think, this time that white-haired bitch isn't going to bring her back. This time she's going to..."
I waited. When nothing came, I said, "Going to what?"
"I told you, I don't know," she said, "but I've been afraid for Kai since spring. By the time June came around, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I put a stop to the visits. Kyra's been off and on pissed at me ever since. I'm pretty sure that's most of what that 4th of July escapade was about. She doesn't talk about her grandfather very much, but she's always popping out with, 'What do you think the white Nana's doing now, Maddie?' Or, 'Do you think the white Nana would like my new dress?' Or she'll run up to me and say, 'Sing, ring, king, thing,' and ask for a treat."
What was the reaction from DeVore?
Complete fury. He called again and again, first asking what was wrong, then making threats.
Physical threats?
Custody threats. He was going to take her away. When he was finished with me, I'd stand before the whole world as an unfit mother. I didn't have a chance. My only hope was to relent and let me see my granddaughter, goddammit.
I nodded. "Please don't shut me out. Doesn't sound like the guy who called while I was watching the fireworks, but that does."
"I've also gotten calls from Dickie Osgood and a number of other locals," she said, "including Lance's old friend, Richie Lattimore. Richie said I wasn't being true to Lance's memory."
"What about George Footman?"
"He cruises by once in a while. Lets me know he's watching. He hasn't called or stopped in. You asked about physical threats. Just seeing Footman's cruiser on my road feels like a physical threat to me. He scares me. But these days it seems as if everything does.
Even though Kyra's visits have stopped.
Even though. It feels thundery, like something's going to happen. And every day that feeling seems to get stronger."
"Mr. Starrow's number," I said. "Do you want it?"
She sat quietly, looking into her lap. Then she raised her head and nodded. "Give it to me, and thank you, from the bottom of my heart."
I had the number on a pink memo slip in my front pocket. She grasped it, but did not immediately take it. Our fingers were touching, and she was looking at me with disconcerting steadiness. It was as if she knew more about my motives than I did myself.
"What can I do to repay you?"
she asked, and there it was.
"Tell Starrow everything you've told me."
I let go of the pink slip and stood up. "That'll do just fine, and now I have to get along. Will you call and tell me how you made out with him?"
"Of course."
We walked to my car. I turned to her when we got there. For a moment, I thought she was going to put her arms around me and hug me, a thank you gesture that might have led anywhere in our current mood, one so heightened it was almost melodramatic. But it was a melodramatic situation, a fairy tale where there's good and bad and a lot of repressed sex running under both. Then headlights appeared over the brow of the hill where the market stood and swept past the all-purpose garage. They moved toward us, brightening. Maddie stood back and actually put her hands behind her like a child who has been scolded. The car passed, leaving us in the dark again, but the moment had passed too, if there had been a moment. "Thanks for dinner," I said. "It was wonderful."
"Thanks for the lawyer. I'm sure he'll be wonderful, too," she said, and we both laughed. The electricity went out of the air.
"He spoke of you once, you know. DeVore." I looked at her in surprise. I'm amazed he even knew who I was. Before this, I mean.
"He knows all right. He spoke of you with what I think was genuine affection."
"You're kidding. You must be."
"I'm not. He said that your great-grandfather and his great-grandfather worked the same camps and were neighbors when they weren't in the woods.
I think he said not far from where Boyd's Marina is now. They shit in the same pit, is the way he put it. Charming, huh? He said he guessed that if a couple of loggers from the TR could produce millionaires, the system was working the way it was supposed to. Even if it took 3 generations to do it, he said. At the time, I took it as a veiled criticism of Lance. It's ridiculous, however he meant it, I said. My family is from the coast, Prout's Neck, other side of the state. My dad was a fisherman, and so was his father before him. My great-grandfather, too. They trapped lobsters and threw nets. They didn't cut trees. All that was true, and yet my mind tried to fix on something. Some memory connected to what she was saying. Perhaps if I slept on it, it would come back to me. Could he have been talking about someone in your wife's family? Nope. There are Arlens in Maine. They're a big family, but most are still in Massachusetts. They do all sorts of things now, but if you go back to the 1880s, the majority would have been quarrymen and stonecutters in the Malden Lynn area. DeVore was pulling your leg, Maddie. But even then, I suppose I knew he wasn't. He might have gotten some part of the story wrong. Even the sharpest guys begin to lose the edge of their recollection by the time they turn 85. But Max DeVore wasn't much of a leg puller. I had an image of unseen cable stretching beneath the surface of the earth here on the TR, stretching in all directions, unseen but very powerful. My hand was resting on top of my car door, and now she touched it briefly. Can I ask you one other question before you go? It's stupid, I warn you. Go ahead. Stupid questions are a specialty of mine. Do you have any idea at all what that Bartleby story is about? I wanted to laugh, but there was enough moonlight for me to see she was serious and that I'd hurt her feelings if I did. She was a member of Lindy Briggs' Reader's Circle, where I had once spoken in the late 80s, probably the youngest by at least 20 years, and she was afraid of appearing stupid. I have to speak first next time, she said, and I'd like to give more than just a summary of the story so they know I've read it. I've thought about it until my head aches, and I just don't see. I doubt if it's one of those stories where everything comes magically clear in the last few pages either. And I feel like I should see that it's right there in front of me. That made me think of the cables again. Cables running in every direction. A subcutaneous webwork connecting people and places. You couldn't see them, but you could feel them, especially if you tried to get away. Meanwhile, Maddie was waiting, looking at me with hope and anxiety. Okay, listen up. School's in session, I said. I am, believe me. Most critics think Huckleberry Finn is the first modern American novel, and that's fair enough. But if Bartleby was 100 pages longer, I think I'd put my money there. Do you know what a scrivener was? A secretary? That's too grand. A copyist, sort of like Bob Cratchit in A Christmas Carol. Only Dickens gives Bob a past and a family life. Melville gives Bartleby neither. He's the first existential character in American fiction, a guy with no ties. No ties to, you know, a couple of loggers who could produce millionaires. They shit in the same pit. Mike? What? Are you okay? Sure. I focused my mind as best I could. Bartleby is tied to life only by work. In that way, he's a 20th century American type, not much different from Sloane Wilson's Man in the Gray Flannel Suit or, in the dark version, Michael Corleone in The Godfather. But then Bartleby begins to question even work, the god of middle-class American males. She looked excited now, and I thought it was a shame she'd missed her last year of high school, for her and also for her teachers. That's why he starts saying, I prefer not to? Yes. Think of Bartleby as a hot air balloon. Only one rope still tethers him to the earth, and that rope is his scrivening. We can measure the rot in that last rope by the steadily increasing number of things Bartleby prefers not to do. Finally, the rope breaks and Bartleby floats away. It's a goddamn disturbing story, isn't it? One night I dreamed about him, she said.
I opened the trailer door, and there he was, sitting on the steps in his old black suit. Thin, not much hair. I said, "Will you move, please? I have to go out and hang the clothes now." And he said, "I prefer not to." "Yes, I guess you could call it disturbing."
"Then it still works," I said, and got into my car. "Call me. Tell me how it goes with John Storrow."
"I will, and anything I can do to repay, just ask."
"Just ask.
How young did you have to be, how beautifully ignorant, to issue that kind of blank check?" My window was open. I reached through it and squeezed her hand. She squeezed back and hard. "You miss your wife a lot, don't you?" she said.
"It shows?"
"Sometimes." She was no longer squeezing, but she was still holding my hand. "When you were reading to Kai, you looked both happy and sad at the same time. I only saw her once, your wife, but I thought she was very beautiful." I had been thinking about the touch of our hands, concentrating on that. Now I forgot about it entirely. "When did you see her? And where? Do you remember?" She smiled as if those were very silly questions. "I remember. It was at the ball field on the night I met my husband." Very slowly, I withdrew my hand from hers. So far as I knew, neither Joe nor I had been near TR-90 all that summer of 94. But what I knew was apparently wrong. Joe had been down on a Tuesday in early July. She had even gone to the softball game. "Are you sure it was Joe?" I asked. Maddie was looking off toward the road. It wasn't my wife she was thinking about. I would have bet the house and lot on it. Either house, either lot. It was Lance. Maybe that was good. If she was thinking about him, she probably wouldn't look too closely at me, and I didn't think I had much control of my expression just then. She might have seen more on my face than I wanted to show. "Yes," she said. "I was standing with Jenna McCoy and Helen Geary. This was after Lance helped me with a keg of beer. I got stuck in the mud and then asked if I was going for pizza with the rest of them after the game. And Jenna said, 'Look, it's Mrs. Noonan.' And Helen said, 'She's the writer's wife, Maddie. Isn't that a cool blouse?' The blouse was all covered with blue roses." I remembered it very well. Joe liked it because it was a joke. There are no blue roses, not in nature and not in cultivation. Once, when she was wearing it, she had thrown her arms extravagantly around my neck, swooned her hips forward against mine, and cried that she was my blue rose and I must stroke her until she turned pink. Remembering that hurt, and badly. "She was over on the third base side, behind the chicken wire screen," Maddie said, "with some guy who was wearing an old brown jacket with patches on the elbows. They were laughing together over something, and then she turned her head a little and looked right at me." She was quiet for a moment, standing there beside my car in her red dress. She raised her hair off the back of her neck, held it, then let it drop again. "Right at me, really seeing me, and she had a look about her. She'd just been laughing, but this look was sad somehow. It was as if she knew me. Then the guy put his arm around her waist, and they walked away." Silence, except for the crickets and the far-off drone of a truck. Maddie only stood there for a moment, as if dreaming with her eyes open, and then she felt something and looked back at me. "Is something wrong?" "No, except who is this guy with his arm around my wife?" She laughed, a little uncertainly. "Well, I doubt if he was her boyfriend, you know. He was quite a bit older, 50 at least." "So what?" I thought. I myself was 40, but that didn't mean I had missed the way Maddie moved inside her dress or lifted her hair from the nape of her neck. "I mean, you're kidding, right?" "I don't really know. There's a lot of things I don't know these days, it seems. But the lady's dead in any case, so how can it matter?" Maddie was looking distressed. "If I put my foot in something, Mike, I'm sorry." "Who was the man? Do you know?" She shook her head. "I thought he was a summer person. There was that feeling about him, maybe just because he was wearing a jacket on a hot summer evening. But if he was, he wasn't staying at Warrington's. I knew most of them."
"And they walked off together?"
"Yes." Sounding reluctant. toward the parking lot?
Yes.
More reluctant still. And this time, she was lying. I knew it with a queer certainty that went far beyond intuition. It was almost like mind reading. I reached through the window and took her hand again. You said if I could think of anything you could do to repay me, to just ask. I'm asking. Tell me the truth, Maddie.
She bit her lip, looking down at my hand lying over hers. Then she looked up at my face. He was a burly guy. The old sport coat made him look a little like a college professor, but he could have been a carpenter for all I know. His hair was black. He had a tan. They had a laugh together, a good one, and then she looked at me and the laugh went out of her face. After that, he put an arm around her and they walked away. She paused. Not toward the parking lot, though. Toward the street. The street. From there, they could have walked north along the edge of the lake until they came to Sarah Laughs. And then, who knew?
She never told me she came down here that summer, I said. Maddie seemed to try several responses and find none of them to her liking. I gave her her hand back. It was time for me to go. In fact, I had started to wish I'd left 5 minutes sooner.
Mike, I'm sure...
No, I said. You're not. Neither am I. But I loved her a lot, and I'm going to try and let this go. It probably signifies nothing, and besides, what else can I do?
Thanks for dinner.
You're welcome. Maddie looked so much like crying that I picked her hand up again and kissed the back of it.
I feel like a dope.
You're not a dope, I said. I gave her hand another kiss, then drove away. And that was my date, the first one in 4 years. Driving home, I thought of an old saying about how one person can never truly know another. It's easy to give that idea lip service, but it's a jolt, as horrible and unexpected as severe air turbulence on a previously calm airline flight, to discover it's a literal fact in one's own life. I kept remembering our visit to a fertility doc after we'd been trying to make a baby for almost 2 years with no success. The doctor had told us I had a low sperm count, not disastrously low, but down enough to account for Joe's failure to conceive. If you want a kid, you'll likely have one without any special help, the doc had said. Both the odds and time are still on your side. It could happen tomorrow, or it could happen 4 years from now. Will you ever fill the house with babies? Probably not, but you might have two, and you'll almost certainly have one if you keep doing the thing that makes them. She had grinned. Remember, the pleasure is in the journey. There had been a lot of pleasure, all right. Many ringings of Bunter's bell, but there had been no baby. Then Joanna had died running across a shopping center parking lot on a hot day, and one of the items in her bag had been a Norco home pregnancy test, which she had not told me she had intended to buy. No more than she told me she had bought a couple of plastic owls to keep the crows from shitting on the lakeside deck. What else hadn't she told me?
Stop, I muttered. For Christ's sake, stop thinking about it.
But I couldn't. When I got back to Sarah, the fruit and vegetable magnets on the refrigerator were in a circle again. Three letters had been clustered in the middle, GD, and below them, O. I moved the O up to where I thought it belonged, between the G and the D, making God, or maybe an abridged version of good. Which meant exactly what?
I could speculate about that, but I prefer not to, I told the empty house.
I looked at Bunter the Moose, willing the bell around his moth-eaten neck to ring. When it didn't, I opened my two new magnabets and stuck them on the fridge door, spreading them out. Then I went down to the north wing, undressed, and brushed my teeth. As I bared my fangs for the mirror in a sudsy cartoon scowl, I considered calling Ward Hankins again tomorrow morning. I could tell him that my search for the elusive plastic owls had progressed from November of 1993 to July of 1994. What meetings had Joe put on her calendar for that month? What excuses to be out of Derry? And once I had finished with Ward, I could tackle Joe's friend, Bonnie Amudson,
ask her if anything had been going on with Joe in the last summer of her life.
Let her rest in peace, why don't you?
It was the UFO voice.
What good will it do you to do otherwise? Assume she popped over to the TR after one of her board meetings, maybe just on a whim, met an old friend, took him back to the house for a bite of dinner. Just dinner.
And never told me? I asked the UFO voice, spitting out a mouthful of toothpaste and then rinsing. Never said a single word?
How do you know she didn't? The voice returned, and that froze me in the act of putting my toothbrush back in the medicine cabinet.
The UFO voice had a point. I had been deep into All the Way from the Top by July of 94. Joe could have come in and told me she'd seen Lon Chaney Jr. dancing with the Queen, doing the Werewolves of London, and I probably would have said, uh-huh, honey, that's nice, as I went on proofing copy.
Bullshit, I said to my reflection. That's just bullshit.
Except it wasn't. When I was really driving on a book, I more or less fell out of the world. Other than a quick scan of the sports pages, I didn't even read the newspaper. So yes, it was possible that Joe had told me she'd run over to the TR after a board meeting in Lewiston or Freeport. It was possible that she'd told me she'd run into an old friend, perhaps another student from the photography seminar she'd attended at Bates in 1991, and it was possible she told me they'd had dinner together on our deck, eating black trumpet mushrooms she'd picked herself as the sun went down. It was possible she told me these things, and I hadn't registered a word of what she was saying. And did I really think I'd get anything I could trust out of Bonnie Amundsen? She'd been Joe's friend, not mine, and Bonnie might feel the statute of limitations hadn't run out on any secrets my wife had told her. The bottom line was as simple as it was brutal. Joe was 4 years dead. Best to love her and let all troubling questions lapse. I took a final mouthful of water directly from the tap, swished it around in my mouth, and spat it out. When I returned to the kitchen to set the coffee maker for 7 a.m., I saw a new message in a new circle of magnets. It read, "Blue Rose Liar, ha ha." I looked at it for a second or two, wondering what had put it there and why, wondering if it were true. I stretched out a hand and scattered all the letters far and wide. Then I went to bed. I caught the measles when I was 8, and I was very ill. "I thought you were going to die," my father told me once, and he was not a man prone to exaggeration. He told me about how he and my mother had dunked me in a tub of cold water one night, both of them at least half convinced the shock of it would stop my heart, but both of them completely convinced that I'd burn up before their eyes if they didn't do something. I had begun to speak in a loud, monotonously discursive voice about the bright figures I saw in the room. Angels come to bear me away, my terrified mother was sure. And the last time my father took my temperature before the cold plunge, he said that the mercury on the old Johnson & Johnson rectal thermometer had stood at 106 degrees. After that, he said, he didn't dare take it anymore. I don't remember any bright figures, but I remember a strange period of time that was like being in a funhouse corridor where several different movies were showing at once. The world grew elastic, bulging in places where it had never bulged before, wavering in places where it had always been solid. People, most of them seeming impossibly tall, darted in and out of my room on scissoring, cartoonish legs. Their words all came out booming with instant echoes. Someone shook a pair of baby shoes in my face. I seem to remember my brother Siddy sticking his arm into his shirt and making repeated arm fart noises. Continuity broke down. Everything came in segments, weird wieners on a poison string. In the years between then and the summer I returned to Sarah Laughs, I had the usual sicknesses, infections and insults to the body, but never anything like that feverish interlude when I was 8. I never expected to, believing, I suppose, that such experiences are unique to children, people with malaria, or maybe those suffering catastrophic mental breakdowns. But on the night of July 7th and the morning of July 8th, I lived through a period of time remarkably like that childhood delirium. Dreaming, waking, moving, they were all one. I'll tell you as best I can, but nothing I say can convey the strangeness of that experience. It was as if I had found a secret passage hidden just beyond the wall of the world and went crawling along it. First there was music, not Dixieland because there were no horns, but like Dixieland, a primitive, reeling kind of bebop. Three or four acoustic guitars, a harmonica, a stand-up bass, or maybe a pair. Behind all this was a hard, happy drumming that didn't sound like it was coming from a real drum. It sounded as if someone with a lot of percussive talent was whopping on a bunch of boxes. Then a woman's voice joined in, a high tenor voice, not quite mannish, roughing over the high notes. It was laughing and urgent and ominous all at the same time, and I knew at once that I was hearing Sarah Tidwell, who had never cut a record in her life. I was hearing Sarah laugh, and man, she was rocking. You know, we're going back to Manderley. We're gonna dance on the Sanderley. I'm gonna sing with the Banderley. We're gonna ball all we can to leave. Ball me, baby, yeah. The basses, yes, there were two, broke out in a barnyard shuffle like the break in Elvis's version of Baby Let's Play House. And then there was a guitar solo, Son Tidwell playing that chicken scratch thing. Lights gleamed in the dark, and I thought of a song from the 50s, Claudine Clark singing Party Lights. And here they were, Japanese lanterns hung from the trees above the path of railroad tie steps leading from the house to the water. Party lights casting mystic circles of radiance in the dark, red, blue, and green. Behind me, Sarah was singing the bridge to her Manderley song, Mama Likes It Nasty, Mama Likes It Strong, Mama Likes to Party All Night Long. But it was fading. Sarah and the Red Top Boys had set up their bandstand in the driveway by the sound, about where George Footman had parked when he came to serve me with Max DeVore's subpoena. I was descending toward the lake through circles of radiance, past party lights surrounded by soft-winged moths. One had found its way inside a lamp, and it cast a monstrous, bat-like shadow against the ribbed paper. The flower boxes Joe had put beside the steps were full of night-blooming roses. In the light of the Japanese lanterns, they looked blue. Now the band was only a faint murmur. I could hear Sarah shouting out the lyric, laughing her way through it as though it were the funniest thing she'd ever heard, all that Manderley, Sanderley, Canderley stuff. But I could no longer make out the individual words. Much clearer was the lap of the lake against the rocks at the foot of the steps, the hollow clunk of the canisters under the swimming float, and the cry of a loon drifting out of the darkness. Someone was standing on the street to my right, at the edge of the lake. I couldn't see his face, but I could see the brown sport coat and the t-shirt he was wearing beneath it. The lapels cut off some of the letters of the message, so it looked like this. Orma? Aun. I knew what it said anyway. In dreams, you almost always know, don't you? Normal sperm count. A village cafe yuck it up special if there ever was one. I was in the north bedroom dreaming all this, and here I woke up enough to know I was dreaming. Except it was like waking into another dream, because Bunter's bell was ringing madly, and there was someone standing in the hall. Mr. Normal Sperm Count? No, not him. The shadow shape falling on the door wasn't quite human. It was slumped, the arms indistinct. I sat up into the silver shaking of the bell, clutching a loose puddle of sheet against my naked waist, sure it was the shroud thing out there. The shroud thing had come out of its grave to get me. Please don't, I said in a dry and trembling voice. Please don't, please. The shadow on the door raised its arms.
It ain't nothing but a bond dance, sugar, Sarah Tidwell's laughing, furious voice sang. It ain't nothing but a round and round.
I laid back down and pulled the sheet over my face in a childish act of denial. And there I stood on our little lick of beach, wearing just my undershorts. My feet were ankle deep in the water. It was warm the way the lake gets by midsummer. My dim shadow was cast two ways, in one direction by the scantling moon which rode low above the water, in another by the Japanese lantern with the moth caught inside it. The man who'd been standing on the path was gone, but he had left a plastic owl to mark his place. It stared at me with frozen, gold-ringed eyes.
Hey, Irish!
I looked out at the swimming float. Joe stood there. She must have just climbed out of the water because she was still dripping and her hair was plastered against her cheeks. She was wearing the two-piece swimsuit from the photo I'd found, gray with red piping.
It's been a long time, Irish. What do you say?
Say about what? I called back, although I knew.
About this.
She put her hands over her breasts and squeezed. Water ran out between her fingers and trickled across her knuckles.
Come on, Irish, she said from beside and above me. Come on, you bastard, let's go.
I felt her strip down the sheet, pulling it easily out of my sleep-numbed fingers. I shut my eyes, but she took my hand and placed it between her legs. As I found that velvety seam and began to stroke it open, she began to rub the back of my neck with her fingers.
You're not Joe, I said. Who are you?
But no one was there to answer. I was in the woods. It was dark, and on the lake the loons were crying. I was walking the path to Joe's studio. It wasn't a dream. I could feel the cool air against my skin and the occasional bite of a rock into my bare sole or heel. A mosquito buzzed around my ear and I waved it away. I was wearing jockey shorts, and at every step they pulled against a huge and throbbing erection.
What the hell is this? I asked as Joe's little barnboard studio loomed in the dark.
I looked behind me and saw Sarah on her hill, not the woman but the house, a long lodge jutting toward the night-bound lake.
What's happening to me?
Everything's all right, Mike, Joe said. She was standing on the float, watching as I swam toward her. She put her hands behind her neck like a calendar model, lifting her breasts more fully into the damp halter. As in the photo, I could see her nipples poking out the cloth. I was swimming in my underpants and with the same huge erection.
Everything's all right, Mike, Maddie said in the north bedroom, and I opened my eyes.
She was sitting beside me on the bed, smooth and naked in the weak glow of the nightlight. Her hair was down, hanging to her shoulders. Her breasts were tiny, the size of teacups, but the nipples were large and distended. Between her legs, where my hand still lingered, was a powder puff of blonde hair, smooth as down. Her body was wrapped in shadows like moth wings, like rose petals. There was something desperately attractive about her as she sat there. She was like the prize you know you'll never win at the Kearney Shooting Gallery or the County Fair Ring Toss, the one they keep on the top shelf. She reached under the sheet and folded her fingers over the stretched material of my undershorts.
Everything's all right. This ain't nothing but a round and round, said the UFO voice as I climbed the steps to my wife's studio.
I stooped, fished for the key from beneath the mat, and took it out. I climbed the ladder to the float, wet and dripping, preceded by my engorged sex. Is there anything, I wonder, so unintentionally comic as a sexually aroused man? Joe stood on the boards in her wet bathing suit. I pulled Maddie into bed with me. I opened the door to Joe's studio. All of these things happened at the same time, weaving in and out of each other like strands of some exotic rope or belt. The thing with Joe felt the most like a dream. The thing in the studio, me crossing the floor and looking down at my old green IBM, the least. Maddie in the north bedroom was somewhere in between. On the float, Joe said, "Do what you want." In the north bedroom, Maddie said, "Do what you want." In the studio, no one had to tell me anything. In there, I knew exactly what I wanted. On the float, I bent my head and put my mouth on one of Joe's breasts and sucked the cloth-covered nipple into my mouth. I tasted damp fabric and dank lake. She reached for me where I stuck out and I slapped her hand away. If she touched me, I would come at once. I sucked, drinking back trickles of cotton water, groping with my own hands, first caressing her ass and then yanking down the bottom half of her suit. I got it off her, and she dropped to her knees. I did too, finally getting rid of my wet, clinging underpants and tossing them on top of her bikini panty. We faced each other that way, me naked, her almost. "Who is the guy at the game?" I panted. "Who was he, Joe?" "No one in particular, Irish. Just another bag of bones." She laughed, then leaned back on her haunches and stared at me. Her navel was a tiny black cup. There was something queerly, attractively snake-like in her posture. "Everything down there is death," she said, and pressed her cold palms and white, pruny fingers to my cheeks. She turned my head and then bent it, so I was looking into the lake. Under the water, I saw decomposing bodies slipping by, pulled by some deep current. Their wet eyes stared. Their fish-nibbled noses gaped. Their tongues lolled between white lips like tendrils of waterweed. Some of the dead trailed pallid balloons of jellyfish guts. Some were little more than bone. Yet not even the sight of this floating charnel parade could divert me from what I wanted. I shrugged my head free of her hands, pushed her down on the boards, and finally cooled what was so hard and contentious, sinking it deep. Her moon-silvered eyes stared up at me, through me, and I saw that one pupil was larger than the other. That was how her eyes had looked on the TV monitor when I had identified her in the Derry County morgue. She was dead. My wife was dead, and I was fucking her corpse. Nor could even that realization stop me. "Who was he?" I cried at her, covering her cold flesh as it lay on the wet boards. "Who was he, Joe? For Christ's sake, tell me who he was." In the north bedroom, I pulled Maddie on top of me, relishing the feel of those small breasts against my chest and the length of her entwining legs. Then I rolled her over on the far side of the bed. I felt her hand reaching for me and slapped it away. If she touched me where she meant to touch me, I would come in an instant. "Spread your legs, hurry," I said, and she did. I closed my eyes, shutting out all other sensory input in favor of this. I pressed forward, then stopped. I made one little adjustment, pushing at my engorged penis with the side of my hand, then rolled my hips and slipped into her like a finger into a silk-lined glove. She looked up at me, wide-eyed, then put a hand on my cheek and turned my head. "Everything out there is death," she said, as if only explaining the obvious. In the window, I saw Fifth Avenue between 50th and 60th, all those trendy shops, Bijan and Bally, Tiffany and Bergdorf's, and Steuben Glass. And here came Harold Oblowski, northbound and swinging his pigskin briefcase, the one Joe and I had given him for Christmas the year before she died. Beside him, carrying a Brentano's bag by the handles, was the bountiful, beauteous Nola, his secretary. Except her bounty was gone. This was a grinning, yellow-jawed skeleton in a Donna Karan suit and alligator pumps. Scrawny, beringed bones gripped the bag handles instead of fingers. Harold's teeth jutted in his usual agent's grin, now extended to the point of obscenity. His favorite suit, the double-breasted charcoal from Paul Stewart, flapped on him like a sail in a fresh breeze. All around them, on both sides of the street, walked the living dead, mommy mummies leading baby corpses by the hands or wheeling them in expensive prams, zombie doormen, reanimated skateboarders.
Here a tall black man, with the last few strips of flesh hanging from his face like cured deer hide, walked his skeleton Alsatian. The cab drivers were rotting to raga music. The faces looking down from the passing buses were skulls, each wearing its own version of Harold's grin. "Hey, how are you? How's the wife? How's the kids? Writing any good books lately?" The peanut vendors were putrefying, yet none of it could quench me. I was on fire. I slipped my hands under her buttocks, lifting her, biting at the sheet. The pattern I saw with no surprise was blue roses, until I pulled it free of the mattress to keep from biting her on the neck, the shoulder, the breasts, anywhere my teeth could reach. "Tell me who he was," I shouted at her. "You know, I know you do." My voice was so muffled by my mouthful of bed linen that I doubted if anyone but me could have understood it. "Tell me, you bitch." On the path between Joe's studio and the house, I stood in the dark with the typewriter in my arms and that dream-spanning erection quivering below its metal bulk, all that ready and nothing willing, except maybe for the night breeze. Then I became aware I was no longer alone. The shroud thing was behind me, called like the moths to the party lights. It laughed. A brazen, smoke-broken laugh that could belong to only one woman. I didn't see the hand that reached around my hip to grip me. The typewriter was in the way, but I didn't need to see it to know its color was brown. It squeezed, slowly tightening, the fingers wriggling. "What do you want to know, sugar?" she asked from behind me, still laughing, still teasing. "Do you really want to know at all? Do you want to know or do you want to feel?" "Oh, you're killing me," I cried. The typewriter, 30 or so pounds of IBM Selectric, was shaking back and forth in my arms. I could feel my muscles twanging like guitar strings. "Do you want to know who he was, sugar, that nasty man?" "Just do me, you bitch," I screamed. She laughed again, that harsh laughter that was almost like a cough. And squeezed me where the squeezing was best. "You hold still now," she said. "You hold still, pretty boy, unless you want me to take fright and yank this thing of yours right out by the..." I lost the rest as the whole world exploded in an orgasm so deep and strong that I thought it would simply tear me apart. I snapped my head back like a man being hung and ejaculated looking up at the stars. I screamed, I had to, and on the lake, two loons screamed back. At the same time, I was on the float. Joe was gone, but I could faintly hear the sound of the band, Sarah and Sonny and the Red Top Boys tearing through Black Mountain Rag. I sat up, dazed and spent, fucked hollow. I couldn't see the path leading up to the house, but I could discern its switchback course by the Japanese lanterns. My underpants lay beside me in a little wet heap. I picked them up and started to put them on, only because I didn't want to swim back to shore with them in my hand. I stopped with them stretched between my knees, looking at my fingers. They were slimed with decaying flesh. Puffing out from beneath several of the nails were clumps of torn-out hair. Corpse hair. "Oh, Jesus," I moaned. The strength went out of me. I flopped into wetness. I was in the north wing bedroom. What I had landed in was hot, and at first I thought it was cum. The dim glow of the nightlight showed darker stuff, however. Maddie was gone, and the bed was full of blood. Lying in the middle of that soaking pool was something I at first glance took to be a clump of flesh or a piece of organ. I looked more closely and saw it was a stuffed animal, a black-furred object matted red with blood. I lay on my side looking at it, wanting to bolt out of the bed and flee from the room, but unable to do it. My muscles were in a dead swoon. Who had I really been having sex with in this bed? And what had I done to her? In God's name, what? "I don't believe these lies," I heard myself say. And as though it were an incantation, I was slapped back together. That isn't exactly what happened, but it's the only way of saying that seems to come close to whatever did. There were three of me, one on the float, one in the north bedroom, one on the path, and each one felt that hard slap as if the wind had grown a fist. There was rushing blackness, and in it the steady silver shaking of Bunter's bell. Then it faded, and I faded with it. For a little while, I was nowhere at all. I came back to the casual chatter of birds on summer vacation and to that peculiar red darkness that means the sun is shining through your closed eyelids. My neck was stiff, my head was canted at a weird angle, my legs were folded awkwardly beneath me, and I was hot. I lifted my head with a wince, knowing even as I opened my eyes that I was no longer in bed, no longer on the swimming float, no longer on the path between the house and the studio. It was floorboards under me, hard and uncompromising. The light was dazzling. I squinched my eyes closed again and groaned like a man with a hangover. I eased them back open behind my cupped hands, gave them time to adjust, then cautiously uncovered them, sat all the way up, and looked around. I was in the upstairs hall, lying under the broken air conditioner. Mrs. Meserve's note still hung from it. Sitting outside my office door was the green IBM with a piece of paper rolled into it. I looked down at my feet and saw that they were dirty. Pine needles were stuck to my soles, and one toe was scratched. I got up, staggered a little, my right leg had gone to sleep, then braced a hand against the wall and stood steady. I looked down at myself. I was wearing the jockeys I'd gone to bed in, and I didn't look as if I'd had an accident in them. I pulled out the waistband and peeked inside. My cock looked as it usually did, small, soft, curled up asleep in its thatch of hair. If Noonan's folly had been adventuring in the night, there was no sign of it now. "It sure felt like an adventure," I croaked. I armed sweat off my forehead. It was stifling up here. Not the kind I ever read about in the Hardy Boys, though. Then I remembered the blood-soaked sheet in the north bedroom and the stuffed animal lying on its side in the middle of it. There was no sense of relief attached to the memory, that thank God it was only a dream feeling you get after a particularly nasty nightmare. It felt as real as any of the things I'd experienced in my measles fever delirium. And all those things had been real, just distorted by my overheated brains. I staggered to the stairs and limped down them, holding tight to the banister in case my tingling leg should buckle. At the foot, I looked dazedly around the living room, as if seeing it for the first time, and then limped down the north wing corridor. The bedroom door was ajar, and for a moment I couldn't bring myself to push it all the way open and go in. I was very badly scared, and my mind kept trying to replay an old episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the one about the man who strangled his wife during an alcoholic blackout. He spent the whole half hour looking for her, and finally found her in the pantry, bloated and open-eyed. Kyra DeVore was the only kid of stuffed animal age I'd met recently, but she had been sleeping peacefully under her cabbage rose coverlet when I left her mother and headed home. It was stupid to think I had driven all the way back to Wasp Hill Road, probably wearing nothing but my jockeys, that I had... what? Raped the woman? Brought the child here? In my sleep? I got the typewriter in my sleep, didn't I? It's sitting right upstairs in the goddamn hallway. Big difference between going 30 yards through the woods and 5 miles down the road to... I wasn't going to stand out here listening to those quarreling voices in my head. If I wasn't crazy, and I didn't think I was, listening to those contentious assholes would probably send me there, and by the express... I reached out and pushed the bedroom door open. For a moment, I actually saw a spreading octopus pattern of blood soaking into the sheet. That's how real and focused my terror was. Then I closed my eyes tight, opened them, and looked again. The sheets were rumpled, the bottom one mostly pulled free. I could see the quilted satin hide of the mattress. One pillow lay on the far edge of the bed, the other was scrunched down at the foot.
The throw rug, a piece of Joe's work, was askew, and my water glass lay overturned on the night table. The bedroom looked as if it might have been the site of a brawl or an orgy, but not a murder. There was no blood and no little stuffed animal with black fur. I dropped to my knees and looked under the bed. Nothing there, not even dust kitties, thanks to Brenda Meserve. I looked at the ground sheet again, first passing a hand over its rumpled topography, then pulling it back down and resecuring the elasticized corners. Great invention, those sheets. If women gave out the Medal of Freedom instead of a bunch of white politicians who never made a bed or washed a load of clothes in their lives, the guy who thought up fitted sheets would undoubtedly have gotten a piece of that tin by now, in a rose garden ceremony. With the sheet pulled taut, I looked again. No blood, not a single drop. There was no stiffening patch of semen either. The former I hadn't really expected, or so I was already telling myself. But what about the latter? At the very least, I'd had the world's most creative wet dream, a triptych in which I had screwed two women and gotten a hand job from a third, all at the same time. I thought I had that morning after feeling, too, the one you get when the previous night's sex has been of the head-busting variety. But if there had been fireworks, where was the burnt gunpowder? In Joe's studio, most likely, I told the empty, sunny room. Or on the path between here and there. Just be glad you didn't leave it in Maddie DeVore, bucko. An affair with a post-adolescent widow you don't need. A part of me disagreed. A part of me thought Maddie DeVore was exactly what I did need. But I hadn't had sex with her last night, any more than I had had sex with my dead wife out on the swimming float or gotten a hand job from Sarah Tidwell. Now that I saw I hadn't killed a nice little kid either, my thoughts turned back to the typewriter. Why had I gotten it? Why bother? Oh, man, what a silly question. My wife might have been keeping secrets from me, maybe even having an affair. There might be ghosts in the house. There might be a rich old man half a mile south who wanted to put a sharp stick into me and then break it off. There might be a few toys in my own humble attic, for that matter. But as I stood there in a bright shaft of sunlight, looking at my shadow on the far wall, only one thought seemed to matter. I had gone out to my wife's studio and gotten my old typewriter, and there was only one reason to do something like that. I went into the bathroom, wanting to get rid of the sweat on my body and the dirt off my feet before doing anything else. I reached for the shower handle, then stopped. The tub was full of water. Either I had for some reason filled it during my sleepwalk, or something else had. I reached for the drain lever, then stopped again, remembering that moment on the shoulder of Route 68 when my mouth had filled up with the taste of cold water. I realized I was waiting for it to happen again. When it didn't, I opened the bathtub drain to let out the standing water and started the shower. I could have brought the Selectric downstairs, perhaps even lugged it out onto the deck where there was a little breeze coming over the surface of the lake, but I didn't. I had brought it all the way to the door of my office, and my office was where I'd work, if I could work. I'd work in there even if the temperature beneath the roof peak built to 120 degrees, which by 3 in the afternoon it just might. The paper rolled into the machine was an old pink carbon receipt from Click, the Photoshop in Castle Rock where Joe had bought her supplies when we were down here. I'd put it in so that the blank side faced the courier type ball. On it, I had typed the names of my little harem, as if I had tried in some struggling way to report on my three-faceted dream even while it was going on. Joe, Sarah, Maddie. Joe, Sarah, Maddie. Maddie, Maddie. Sarah, Sarah. Joe, Joanna, Sarah, Joe, Maddie, Sarah, Joe. Below this, in lower case, normal sperm count. Sperm norm. All's rosy. I opened the office door, carried the typewriter in, and put it in its old place beneath the poster of Richard Nixon. I pulled the pink slip out of the roller, balled it up, and tossed it into the wastebasket. Then I picked up the Selectric's plug and stuck it in the baseboard socket. My heart was beating hard and fast, the way it had when I was 13 and climbing the ladder to the high board at the Y pool. I had climbed that ladder 3 times when I was 12 and then slunk back down it again. Once I turned 13, there could be no chickening out. I really had to do it. I thought I'd seen a fan hiding in the far corner of the closet behind the box marked Gadgets. I started in that direction, then turned around again with a ragged little laugh. I'd had moments of confidence before, hadn't I? Yes. And then the iron bands had clamped around my chest. It would be stupid to get out the fan and then discover I had no business in this room after all. "Take it easy," I said. "Take it easy." But I couldn't, no more than that narrow-chested boy in the ridiculous purple bathing suit had been able to take it easy when he walked to the end of the diving board, the pool so green below him, the upraised faces of the boys and girls in it so small. So small. I bent to one of the drawers on the right side of the desk and pulled so hard it came all the way out. I got my bare foot out of its landing zone just in time and barked a gust of loud, humorless laughter. There was half a ream of paper in the drawer. The edges had that faintly crispy look paper gets when it's been sitting for a long time. I no more than saw it before remembering I had brought my own supply, stuff a good deal fresher than this. I left it where it was and put the drawer back in its hole. It took several tries to get it on its tracks. My hands were shaking. At last I sat down in my desk chair, hearing the same old creaks as it took my weight and the same old rumble of the casters as I rolled it forward, snugging my legs into the knee hole. Then I sat facing the keyboard, sweating hard, still remembering the high board at the Y, how springy it had been under my bare feet as I walked its length, remembering the echoing quality of the voices below me, remembering the smell of chlorine and the steady low throb of the air exchangers, fwung, 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 as if the water had its own secret heartbeat. I had stood at the end of the board wondering, and not for the first time, if you could be paralyzed if you hit the water wrong. Probably not, but you could die of fear. There were documented cases of that in Ripley's Believe It or Not, which served me as science between the ages of 8 and 14. "Go on," Joe's voice cried. My version of her voice was usually calm and collected. This time it was shrill. "Stop dithering and go on." I reached for the IBM's rocker switch, now remembering the day I had dropped my Word 6 program into the PowerBook's trash. "Goodbye, old pal," I had thought. "Please let this work," I said. "Please." I lowered my hand and flicked the switch. The machine came on. The courier ball did a preliminary twirl, like a ballet dancer standing in the wings waiting to go on. I picked up a piece of paper, saw my sweaty fingers were leaving marks, and didn't care. I rolled it into the machine, centered it, then wrote Chapter 1 and waited for the storm to break. The ringing of the phone, or more accurately, the way I received the ringing of the phone, was as familiar as the creaks of my chair or the hum of the old IBM Selectric. It seemed to come from far away at first, then to approach like a whistling train coming down on a crossing. There was no extension in my office or Joe's. The upstairs phone, an old-fashioned rotary dial, was on a table in the hall between them, in what Joe used to call no man's land. The temperature out there must have been at least 90 degrees, but the air still felt cool on my skin after the office. I was so oiled with sweat that I looked like a slightly pot-bellied version of the muscle boys I sometimes saw when I was working out. "Hello? Mike, did I wake you? Were you sleeping?" It was Maddie, but a different one from last night. This one wasn't afraid or even tentative. This one sounded so happy she was almost bubbling over. It was almost certainly the Maddie who had attracted Lance DeVore. "Not sleeping," I said, "writing a little." "Get out. I thought you were retired." "I thought so, too," I said, "but maybe I was a little hasty. What's going on? You sound over the moon." "I just got off the phone with John Starrow." "Really?
How long had I been on the second floor, anyway? I looked at my wrist and saw nothing but a pale circle. It was 1:30 freckles and skin o'clock, as we used to say when we were kids. My watch was downstairs in the north bedroom, probably lying in a puddle of water from my overturned night glass.
His agent that he can subpoena the other son.
Whoa, I said. You lost me. Go back and slow down. She did. Telling the hard news didn't take long. It rarely does. Starro was coming up tomorrow. He would land at County Airport and stay at the Lookout Rock Hotel in Castle View. The two of them would spend most of Friday discussing the case.
Oh, and he found a lawyer for you, she said, to go with you to your deposition. I think he's from Lewiston.
It all sounded good, but what mattered a lot more than the bare facts was that Maddie had recovered her will to fight. Until this morning, if it was still morning, the light coming in the window above the broken air conditioner suggested that if it was, it wouldn't be much longer. I hadn't realized how gloomy the young woman in the red sundress and tidy white sneakers had been, how far down the road to believing she would lose her child.
This is great. I'm so glad, Maddie.
And you did it. If you were here, I'd give you the biggest kiss you ever had.
He told you you could win, didn't he?
Yes.
And you believe him?
Yes. Then her voice dropped a little. He wasn't exactly thrilled when I told him I'd head you over to dinner last night, though.
No, I said. I didn't think he would be.
I told him we ate in the yard, and he said we only had to be inside together for 60 seconds to start the gossip.
I'd say he's got an insultingly low opinion of Yankee lovin', I said, but of course, he's from New York.
She laughed harder than my little joke warranted, I thought, out of semi-hysterical relief that she now had a couple of protectors, because the whole subject of sex was a tender one for her just now. Best not to speculate. He didn't paddle me too hard about it, but he made it clear that he would if we did it again. When this is over, though, I'm having you for a real meal. We'll have everything you like, just the way you like it.
Everything you like, just the way you like it.
And she was, by God and Sonny Jesus, completely unaware that what she was saying might have another meaning. I would have bet on it. I closed my eyes for a moment, smiling. Why not smile? Everything she was saying sounded absolutely great, especially once you cleared the confines of Michael Noonan's dirty mind. It sounded like we might have the expected fairy tale ending if we could keep our courage and hold our course, and if I could restrain myself from making a pass at a girl young enough to be my daughter, outside of my dreams, that was. If I couldn't, I probably deserved whatever I got. But Kyra wouldn't. She was the hood ornament in all this, doomed to go wherever the car took her. If I got any of the wrong ideas, I'd do well to remember that. If the judge sends DeVore home empty-handed, I'll take you out to Renoir Nights in Portland and buy you 9 courses of French chow, I said. Starro, too. I'll even spring for the legal beagle I'm dating on Friday. So who's better than me, huh?
No one I know, she said, sounding serious. I'll pay you back for this, Mike. I'm down now, but I won't always be down. If it takes me the rest of my life, I'll pay you back.
Maddie, you don't have to.
I do, she said with quiet vehemence. I do. And I have to do something else today, too.
What's that? I loved hearing her sound the way she did this morning, so happy and free, like a prisoner who has just been pardoned and let out of jail. But already I was looking longingly at the door to my office. I couldn't do much more today. I'd end up baked like an apple if I tried. But I wanted another page or two at least. Do what you want, both women had said in my dreams. Do what you want. I have to buy Kyra, the big teddy bear they have at the Castle Rock Walmart, she said. I'll tell her it's for being a good girl because I can't tell her it's for walking in the middle of the road when you were coming the other way.
Just not a black one, I said.
The words were out of my mouth before I knew they were even in my head.
Huh?
Sounding startled and doubtful.
I said, bring me back one, I said, the words once again out and down the wire before I even knew they were there.
Maybe I will, she said, sounding amused.
Then her tone grew serious again. "And if I said anything last night that made you unhappy, even for a minute, I'm sorry. I never for the world..."
"Don't worry," I said. "I'm not unhappy. A little confused, that's all. In fact, I'd pretty much forgotten about Joe's mystery date."
A lie, but in what seemed to me to be a good cause.
"That's probably for the best.
I won't keep you. Go on back to work. It's what you want to do, isn't it?"
I was startled. "What makes you say that?"
"I don't know, I just..."
She stopped, and I suddenly knew two things, what she had been about to say and that she wouldn't say it.
"I dreamed about you last night. I dreamed about us together. We were going to make love, and one of us said, 'Do what you want.' Or maybe, I don't know, maybe we both said it."
Perhaps sometimes ghosts were alive, minds and desires divorced from their bodies, unlocked impulses floating unseen, ghosts from the id, spooks from low places.
"Maddie, still there?"
"Sure, you bet. Do you want me to stay in touch, or will you hear all you need from Mr. Starrow?"
"If you don't stay in touch, I'll be pissed at you, royally."
She laughed. "I will then, but not when you're working. Goodbye, Mike, and thanks again, so much."
I told her goodbye, then stood there for a moment, looking at the old-fashioned Bakelite phone handset after she had hung up. She'd call and keep me updated, but not when I was working.
How would she know when that was?
She just would. As I'd known last night that she was lying when she said Joe and the man with the elbow patches on the sleeves of his sport coat had walked off toward the parking lot. Maddie had been wearing a pair of white shorts and a halter top when she called me. No dress or skirt required today because it was Wednesday and the library was closed on Wednesday.
"You don't know any of that. You're just making it up."
But I wasn't. If I'd been making it up, I probably would have put her in something a little more suggestive, a merry widow from Victoria's Secret, perhaps. That thought called up another. "Do what you want," they had said, both of them. "Do what you want." And that was a line I knew. While on Key Largo, I'd read an Atlantic Monthly essay on pornography by some feminist. I wasn't sure which one, only that it hadn't been Naomi Wolf or Camille Paglia. This woman had been of the conservative stripe, and she had used that phrase. Sally Tisdale, maybe? Or was my mind just hearing echo distortions of Sarah Tidwell? Whoever it had been, she'd claimed that "do what I want" was the basis of erotica which appealed to women, and "do what you want" was the basis of pornography which appealed to men. Women imagine speaking the former line in sexual situations. Men imagine having the latter line spoken to them. And the writer went on, when real-world sex goes bad, sometimes turning violent, sometimes shaming, sometimes just unsuccessful from the female partner's point of view, porn is often the unindicted co-conspirator. The man is apt to round on the woman angrily and cry, "You wanted me to. Quit lying and admit it. You wanted me to." The writer claimed it was what every man hoped to hear in the bedroom. "Do what you want. Bite me. Sodomize me. Lick between my toes. Drink wine out of my navel. Give me a hairbrush and raise your ass for me to paddle. It doesn't matter. Do what you want. The door is closed and we are here, but really only you are here. I am just a willing extension of your fantasies and only you are here. I have no wants of my own, no needs of my own, no taboos. Do what you want to this shadow, this fantasy, this ghost." I'd thought the essayist at least 50% full of shit. The assumption that a man can only find real sexual pleasure by turning a woman into a kind of jack-off accessory says more about the observer than the participants. This lady had had a lot of jargon and a fair amount of wit, but underneath she was only saying what Somerset Maugham, Joe's old favorite, had had Sadie Thompson say in Rain, a story written 80 years before. Men are beasts, selfish beasts, all of them. But we are not beasts, as a rule, or at least not unless we are pushed to the final extremity. And if we are pushed to it, the issue is rarely sex, it's usually territory.
I've heard feminists argue that to men, sex and territory are interchangeable, and that is very far from the truth. I padded back to the office, opened the door, and behind me the telephone rang again. And here was another familiar sensation, back for a return visit after 4 years. That anger at the telephone, the urge to simply rip it out of the wall and fire it across the room. Why did the whole world have to call while I was writing? Why couldn't they just, well, let me do what I wanted? I gave a doubtful laugh and returned to the phone, seeing the wet handprint on it from my last call. Hello? I said to stay visible while you were with her. Good morning to you too, Lawyer Storrow. You must be in another time zone up there, chum. I've got 1:15 down here in New York. I had dinner with her, I said. Outside. It's true that I read the little kid a story and helped put her to bed, but I imagine half the town thinks you're bopping each other's brains out by now, and the other half will think it if I have to show up for her in court. But he didn't sound really angry. I thought he sounded as though he were having a happy face day. Can they make you tell who's paying for your services? I asked. At the custody hearing, I mean? Nope. At my deposition on Friday? Christ, no. Durgan would lose all credibility as guardian ad litem if he went in that direction. Also, they have reasons to steer clear of the sex angle. Their focus is on Maddie as neglectful and perhaps abusive. Proving that Mom isn't a nun quit working around the time Kramer vs. Kramer came out in the movie theaters. Nor is that the only problem they have with the issue. He now sounded positively gleeful. Tell me. Max DeVore is 85 and divorced, twice divorced in point of fact. Before awarding custody to a single man of his age, secondary custody has to be taken into consideration. It is, in fact, the single most important issue, other than the allegations of abuse and neglect leveled at the mother. What are those allegations? Do you know? No, Maddie doesn't either, because they're fabrications. She's a sweetie, by the way. Yeah, she is. And I think she's going to make a great witness. I can't wait to meet her in person. Meantime, don't sidetrack me. We're talking about secondary custody, right? Right. DeVore has a daughter who has been declared mentally incompetent and lives in an institution somewhere in California. Modesto, I think. Not a good bet for custody. It wouldn't seem so. He also has a son by his second marriage, Roger. His age is, I heard a faint fluttering of notebook pages, 59. So he's not exactly a spring chicken either. Still, there are lots of guys who become daddies at that age nowadays. It's a brave new world, but Roger is a homosexual. I thought of Bill Dean saying, "Rump Wrangler. Understand there's a lot of that going around out there in California." I thought you said sex doesn't matter. Maybe I should have said heterosex doesn't matter. In certain states, California is one of them, homosex doesn't matter either, or not as much. But this case isn't going to be adjudicated in California. It's going to be adjudicated in Maine, where folks are less enlightened about how well two married men, married to each other, I mean, can raise a little girl. Roger DeVore is married? Okay, I admit it. I now felt a certain horrified glee myself. I was ashamed of it. Roger DeVore was just a guy living his life, and he might not have had much or anything to do with his elderly dad's current enterprise, but I felt it just the same. He and a software designer named Morris Ridding tied the knot in 1996, John said. I found that on the first computer sweep, and if this does wind up in court, I intend to make as much of it as I possibly can. I don't know how much that will be. At this point, it's impossible to predict. But if I get a chance to paint a picture of that bright-eyed, cheerful little girl growing up with two elderly gays who probably spend most of their lives in computer chat rooms speculating about what Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock might have done after the lights were out in Officer's Country, well, if I get that chance, I'll take it. It seems a little mean, I said. I heard myself speaking in the tone of a man who wants to be dissuaded, perhaps even laughed at, but that didn't happen.
Of course it's mean. It feels like swerving up onto the sidewalk to knock over a couple of innocent bystanders. Roger DeVore and Morris Ridding don't deal drugs, traffic in little boys, or rob old ladies. But this is custody, and custody does an even better job than divorce of turning human beings into insects. This one isn't as bad as it could be, but it's bad enough because it's so naked. Max DeVore came up there to his old hometown for one reason and one reason only, to buy a kid. That makes me mad. I grinned, imagining a lawyer who looked like Elmer Fudd standing outside a rabbit hole marked DeVore with a shotgun. My message to DeVore is going to be very simple. The price of the kid just went up, probably to a figure higher than even he can afford. If it goes to court. You've said that a couple of times now. Do you think there's a chance DeVore might just drop it and go away? A pretty good one, yeah. I'd say an excellent one if he wasn't old and used to getting his own way. There's also the question of whether or not he's still sharp enough to know where his best interest lies. I'll try for a meeting with him and his lawyer while I'm up there, but so far I haven't managed to get past his secretary. Rogette Whitmore? Nah, I think she's a step further up the ladder. I haven't talked to her yet either, but I will. Try either Richard Osgood or George Footman, I said. Either of them may be able to put you in touch with DeVore or DeVore's chief counsel. I'll want to talk to the Whitmore woman in any case. Men like DeVore tend to grow more and more dependent on their close advisors as they grow older, and she could be a key to getting him to let this go. She could also be a headache for us. She might urge him to fight, possibly because she really thinks he can win, and possibly because she wants to watch the fur fly. Also, she might marry him. Marry him? Why not? He could ever sign a prenup. I could no more introduce that in court than his lawyers could go fishing for who hired Maddie's lawyer, and it would strengthen his chances. John, I've seen the woman. She's got to be 70 herself. But she's a potential female player in a custody case involving a little girl, and she's a layer between old man DeVore and the married gay couple. We just need to keep it in mind. Okay. I looked at the office door again, but not so longingly. There comes a point when you're done for the day, whether you want to be or not, and I thought I had reached that point. Perhaps in the evening. The lawyer I got for you is named Romeo Bissonette. He paused. Can that be a real name? Is he from Lewiston? Yes, how'd you know? Because in Lewiston that can be a real name. Am I supposed to go see him? I didn't want to go see him. It was 50 miles to Lewiston over 2-lane roads, which would now be crawling with campers and Winnebagoes. What I wanted was to go swimming and then take a long nap. A long, dreamless nap. You don't need to. Call him and talk to him a little. He's only a safety net, really. He'll object if the questioning leaves the incident on the morning of July 4th. About that incident, you tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Got it? Yes. Talk to him before, then meet him on Friday at... Wait, it's right here. The notebook pages fluttered again. Meet him at the Route 120 diner at 9:15. Coffee. Talk a little, get to know each other, maybe flip for the check. I'll be with Maddie, getting as much as I can. We may want to hire a private dick. I love it when you talk dirty. Uh-huh. I'm going to see that the bills go to your guy Goldacre. He'll send them to your agent, and your agent can... No, I said. Instruct Goldacre to send them directly here. Harold's a Jewish mother. How much is this going to cost me? $75,000, minimum, he said with no hesitation at all, with no apology in his voice either. Don't tell Maddie. All right. Are you having any fun yet, Mike? You know, I sort of am, I said thoughtfully. For $75,000, you should. We said our goodbyes, and John hung up. As I put my own phone back into its cradle, it occurred to me that I had lived more in the last 5 days than I had in the last 4 years. This time the phone didn't ring, and I made it all the way back into the office, but I knew I was definitely done for the day. I sat down at the IBM, hit the return key a couple of times, and then began to write myself a next note at the bottom of the page I'd been working on when the phone interrupted me.
What a sour little doodad the telephone is, and what little good news we get from it. Today had been an exception, though, and I thought I could sign off with a grin. I was working, after all. Working. Part of me still marveled that I was sitting here at all, breathing easily, my heart beating steadily in my chest, and not even a glimmer of an anxiety attack on my personal event horizon. I wrote, "Next, Drake to Rayford. Stops on the way at vegetable stand to talk to the guy who runs it, Old Source, needs a good and colorful name. Straw hat, Disney World t-shirt, they talk about Shackelford." I turned the roller until the IBM spat this page out, stuck it on top of the manuscript, and jotted a final note to myself. Call Ted Rosenkrief about Rayford. Rosenkrief was a retired Navy man who lived in Derry. I had employed him as a research assistant on several books, using him on one project to find out how paper was made, what the migratory habits of certain common birds were for another, a little bit about the architecture of pyramid burial rooms for a third. And it's always a little bit I want, never the whole damn thing. As a writer, my motto has always been, don't confuse me with the facts. The Arthur Haley type of faction is beyond me. I can't read it, let alone write it. I want to know just enough so I can lie colorfully. Rosie knew that, and we had always worked well together. This time I needed to know a little bit about Florida's Rayford Prison and what the death house down there was really like. I also needed a little bit on the psychology of serial killers. I thought Rosie would probably be glad to hear from me, almost as glad as I was to finally have something to call him about. I picked up the 8 double-spaced pages I had written and fanned through them, still amazed at their existence. Had an old IBM typewriter and a courier type bulb been the secret all along? That was certainly how it seemed. What had come out was also amazing. I'd had ideas during my 4-year sabbatical. There had been no writer's block in that regard. One had been really great, the sort of thing which certainly would have become a novel if I'd still been able to write novels. Half a dozen to a dozen were of the sort I'd classify pretty good, meaning they'd do in a pinch, or if they happened to unexpectedly grow tall and mysterious overnight like Jack's beanstalk. Sometimes they do. Most were glimmers, little what-ifs that came and went like shooting stars while I was driving or walking or just lying in bed at night and waiting to go to sleep. The red shirt man was a what-if. One day I saw a man in a bright red shirt washing the show window of the J.C. Penney store in Derry. This was not long before Penney's moved out to the mall. A young man and woman walked under his ladder. Very bad luck, according to the old superstition. These two didn't know where they were walking, though. They were holding hands, drinking deep of each other's eyes, as completely in love as any 2 20-year-olds in the history of the world. The man was tall, and as I watched, the top of his head came within an ace of clipping the window washer's feet. If that had happened, the whole works might have gone over. The entire incident was history in 5 seconds. Writing The Red Shirt Man took 5 months, except in truth, the entire book was done in a what-if second. I imagined a collision instead of a near miss. Everything else followed from there. The writing was just secretarial. The idea I was currently working on wasn't one of Mike's really great ideas, Joe's voice carefully made the capitals, but it wasn't a what-if either. Nor was it much like my old gothic suspense yarns. V.C. Andrews with a prick was nowhere in sight this time. But it felt solid, like the real thing, and this morning it had come out as naturally as a breath. Andy Drake was a private investigator in Key Largo. He was 40 years old, divorced, the father of a 3-year-old girl. At the opening, he was in the Key West home of a woman named Regina Whiting. Mrs. Whiting also had a little girl, hers 5 years old. Mrs. Whiting was married to an extremely rich developer who did not know what Andy Drake knew, that until 1992, Regina Taylor Whiting had been Tiffany Taylor, a high-priced Miami call girl.
That much I had written before the phone started ringing. Here is what I knew beyond that point, the secretarial work I'd do over the next several weeks, assuming that my marvelously recovered ability to work held up. One day when Karen Whiting was 3, the phone had rung while she and her mother had been sitting in the patio hot tub. Regina thought of asking the yard guy to answer it, then decided to get it herself. Their regular man was out with a flu, and she didn't feel comfortable about asking a stranger for a favor. Cautioning her daughter to sit still, Regina hopped out to answer the phone. When Karen put up a hand to keep from being splashed as her mother exited the tub, she dropped the doll she had been bathing. When she bent to pick it up, her hair became caught in one of the hot tub's powerful intakes. It was reading of a fatal accident like this that had originally kicked the story off in my mind 2 or 3 years before. The yard man, some no-name in a khaki shirt sent over by a day labor outfit, saw what was happening. He raced across the lawn, dove headfirst into the tub, and yanked the child from the bottom, leaving hair and a good chunk of scalp clogging the jet when he did. He'd give her artificial respiration until she began to breathe again. This would be a wonderful, suspenseful scene, and I couldn't wait to write it. He would refuse all of the hysterical, relieved mother's offers of recompense, although he'd finally give her an address so that her husband could talk to him. Only both the address and his name, John Sanborn, would turn out to be a fake. 2 years later, the ex-hooker with the respectable second life sees the man who saved her child on the front page of the Miami paper. His name is given as John Shackelford, and he has been arrested for the rape murder of a 9-year-old girl. And, the article goes on, he is suspected in over 40 other murders, many of them children. "Have you caught baseball cap?" one of the reporters would yell at the press conference. "Is John Shackelford baseball cap?" "Well," I said, going downstairs, "they sure think he is." I could hear too many boats out on the lake this afternoon to make nude bathing an option. I pulled on my suit, slung a towel over my shoulders, and started down the path, the one which had been lined with glowing paper lanterns in my dream, to wash off the sweat of my nightmares and my unexpected morning's labors. There are 23 railroad tie steps between Sarah and the lake. I had gone down only 4 or 5 before the enormity of what had just happened hit me. My mouth began to tremble. The colors of the trees and the sky mixed together as my eyes teared up. A sound began to come out of me, a kind of muffled groaning. The strength ran out of my legs and I sat down hard on a railroad tie. For a moment I thought it was over, mostly just a false alarm, and then I began to cry. I stuffed one end of the towel in my mouth during the worst of it, afraid that if the boaters on the lake heard the sounds coming out of me, they'd think someone up here was being murdered. I cried in grief for the empty years I had spent without Joe, without friends, and without my work. I cried in gratitude because those years seemed to be over. It was too early to tell for sure. One swallow doesn't make a summer, and 8 pages of hard copy doesn't make a career resuscitation. But I thought it really might be so. And I cried out of fear as well, as we do when some awful experience is finally over, or when some terrible accident has been narrowly averted. I cried because I suddenly realized that I had been walking a white line ever since Joe died, walking straight down the middle of the road. By some miracle, I had been carried out of harm's way, just as I had carried Kyra. I had no idea who had done the carrying, but that was all right. It was a question that could wait for another day. I cried it all out of me. Then I went on down to the lake and waded in. The cool water felt more than good on my overheated body. It felt like a resurrection. State your name for the record. Michael Noonan. Your address? Derry is my permanent address, 14 Benton Street, but I also maintain a home in TR90 on Darkscore Lake. The mailing address is Box 832, The actual house is on Lane 42 off Route 68. Elmer Durgan, Kyra DeVore's guardian ad litem, waved a pudgy hand in front of his face, either to shoo away some troublesome insect or to tell me that was enough. I agreed that it was. I felt rather like the little girl in Our Town who gave her address as Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, America, the Northern Hemisphere, the World, the Solar System, the Milky Way Galaxy, the Mind of God. Mostly, I was nervous. I'd reached the age of 40, still a virgin in the area of court proceedings, and although we were in the conference room of Durgan, Peters, and Jurette on Bridge Street in Castle Rock, this was still a court proceeding. There was one mentionably odd detail to these festivities. The stenographer wasn't using one of those keyboards on a post that looked like adding machines, but a steno mask, a gadget which fit over the lower half of his face. I had seen them before, but only in old black-and-white crime movies, the ones where Dan Duryea or John Payne is always driving around in a Buick with portholes on the sides, looking grim and smoking Camels. Glancing over into the corner and seeing a guy who looked like the world's oldest fighter pilot was weird enough, but hearing everything you said immediately repeated in a muffled monotone was even weirder. "Thank you, Mr. Noonan. My wife has read all your books and says you are her favorite author. I just wanted to get that on the record." Durgan chuckled fatly. Why not? He was a fat guy. Most fat people I like. They have expansive natures to go with their expansive waistlines. But there is a subgroup which I think of as the evil little fat folks. You don't want to fuck with the elves if you can help it. They will burn your house and rape your dog if you give them half an excuse and a quarter of an opportunity. Few of them stand over 5'2", Durgan's height I estimated, and many are under 5 feet. They smile a lot, but their eyes don't smile. The evil little fat folks hate the whole world. Mostly they hate folks who can look down the length of their bodies and still see their own feet. This included me, although just barely. "Please thank your wife for me, Mr. Durgan. I'm sure she could recommend one for you to start on." Durgan chuckled. On his right, Durgan's assistant, a pretty young woman who looked approximately 17 minutes out of law school, chuckled. On my left, Romeo Bissonette chuckled. In the corner, the world's oldest F-111 pilot only went on muttering into his steno mask. "I'll wait for the big screen version," he said. His eyes gave an ugly little gleam, as if he knew a feature film had never been made from one of my books, only a made-for-TV movie of Being 2 that pulled ratings roughly equal to the National Sofa Refinishing Championships. I hoped that we'd completed this chubby little fuck's idea of the pleasantries. "I am Kyra DeVore's guardian ad litem," he said. "Do you know what that means, Mr. Noonan?" "I believe I do." "It means," Durgan rolled on, "that I've been appointed by Judge Rancourt to decide, if I can, where Kyra DeVore's best interests lie, should a custody judgment become necessary. Judge Rancourt would not, in such an event, be required to base his decision on my conclusions, but in many cases that is what happens." He looked at me with his hands folded on a blank legal pad. The pretty assistant, on the other hand, was scribbling madly. Perhaps she didn't trust the fighter pilot. Durgan looked as if he expected a round of applause. "Was that a question, Mr. Durgan?" I asked, and Romeo Bissonette delivered a light, practiced chip to my ankle. I didn't need to look at him to know it wasn't an accident. Durgan pursed lips so smooth and damp that he looked as if he were wearing a clear gloss on them. On his shining pate, roughly 2 dozen strands of hair were combed in smooth little arcs. He gave me a patient, measuring look. Behind it was all the intransigent ugliness of an evil little fat folk. The pleasantries were over, all right. I was sure of it. "No, Mr. Noonan, that was not a question. I simply thought you might like to know why we've had to ask you to come away from your lovely lake on such a pleasant morning. Perhaps I was wrong. Now if..." There was a peremptory knock on the door, followed by your friend and his, George Footman. Today, Cleveland Casual had been replaced by a khaki deputy sheriff's uniform,
complete with Sam Brown belt and sidearm. He helped himself to a good look at the assistant's bust line, displayed in a green silk blouse, then handed her a folder and a cassette tape recorder. He gave me one brief gander before leaving. "I remember you, buddy," that glance said. "The smart-ass writer. The cheap date." Romeo Bissonette tipped his head toward me. He used the side of his hand to bridge the gap between his mouth and my ear. "Divorce tape," he said. I nodded to show I understood, then turned to Durgan again. "Mr. Noonan, you've met Kyra DeVore and her mother, Mary DeVore, haven't you?" How did you get Maddie out of Mary, I wondered, and then knew, just as I had known about the white shorts and halter top. Maddie was how Kai had first tried to save Mary. "Mr. Noonan, are we keeping you up?" "There's no need to be sarcastic, is there?" Bissonette asked. His tone was mild, but Elmer Durgan gave him a look which suggested that, should the elves succeed in their goal of world domination, Bissonette would be aboard the first gulag-bound boxcar. "I'm sorry," I said before Durgan could reply. "I just got derailed there for a second or two." "New story idea?" Durgan asked, smiling his glossy smile. He looked like a swamp toad in a sport coat. He turned to the old jet pilot, told him to strike that last, then repeated his question about Kyra and Maddie. "Yes," I said, "I had met them." "Once or more than once?" "More than once." "How many times have you met them?" "Twice." "Have you also spoken to Mary DeVore on the phone?" Already these questions were moving in a direction that made me uncomfortable. "Yes." "How many times?" "Three times." The third had come the day before when she had asked if I would join her and John Starrow for a picnic lunch on the town common after my deposition. Lunch right there in the middle of town before God and everybody. Although, with a New York lawyer to play chaperone, what harm in that? "Have you spoken to Kyra DeVore on the telephone?" What an odd question. Not one anybody had prepared me for, either. I suppose that was at least partly why he had asked it. "Mr. Noonan?" "Yes, I've spoken to her once." "Can you tell us the nature of that conversation?" "Well..." I looked doubtfully at Bissonette, but there was no help there. He obviously didn't know either. "Maddie, pardon me?" Durgan leaned forward as much as he could. His eyes were intent in their pink pockets of flesh. "Maddie?" "Maddie DeVore. Mary DeVore." "You call her Maddie?" "Yes," I said, and had a wild impulse to add, in bed I call her that. "Oh, Maddie, don't stop," I cry. "It's the name she gave me when she introduced herself. I met her..." "We may get to that, but right now I'm interested in your telephone conversation with Kyra DeVore. When was that?" "It was yesterday, July 9th, 1998. "Yes." "Who placed that call?" Mary DeVore." "Now he'll ask why she called," I thought, "and I'll say she wanted to have yet another sex marathon, foreplay to consist of feeding each other chocolate-dipped strawberries while we look at pictures of naked malformed dwarves." "How did Kyra DeVore happen to speak to you?" "She asked if she could. I heard her saying to her mother that she had to tell me something." "What was it she had to tell you?" "That she had her first bubble bath." "Did she also say she coughed?" I was quiet, looking at him. In that moment, I understood why people hate lawyers, especially when they've been dusted over by one who's good at his job. "Mr. Noonan, would you like me to repeat the question?" "No," I said, wondering where he'd gotten his information. Had these bastards tapped Maddie's phone? My phone? Both? Perhaps for the first time, I understood on a gut level what it must be like to have $500 million. With that much dough, you could tap a lot of telephones. "She said her mother pushed bubbles in her face and she coughed, but she was..." "Thank you, Mr. Noonan. Now let's turn to..." "Let him finish," Bissonette said. I had an idea he had already taken a bigger part in the proceedings than he had expected to, but he didn't seem to mind. He was a sleepy-looking man with a bloodhound's mournful, trustworthy face. This isn't a courtroom, and you're not cross-examining him.
I have the little girl's welfare to think of, Durgan said. He sounded both pompous and humble at the same time, a combination that went together like chocolate sauce on creamed corn. It's a responsibility I take very seriously. If I seem to be badgering you, Mr. Noonan, I apologize.
I didn't bother accepting his apology. That would have made us both phonies. All I was going to say is that Kai was laughing when she said it. She said she and her mother had a bubble fight. When her mother came back on, she was laughing, too.
Durgan had opened the folder Footman had brought him and was paging rapidly through it while I spoke, as if he wasn't hearing a word.
Her mother, Maddie, as you call her.
Yes, Maddie, as I call her.
How do you know about our private telephone conversation in the first place?
That's none of your business, Mr. Noonan.
He selected a single sheet of paper, then closed the folder. He held the paper up briefly, like a doctor studying an X-ray, and I could see it was covered with single-space typing.
Let's turn to your initial meeting with Mary and Kyra DeVore. That was on the 4th of July, wasn't it?
Yes.
Durgan was nodding. The morning of the 4th. And you met Kyra DeVore first?
Yes.
You met her first because her mother wasn't with her at the time, was she?
That's a badly phrased question, Mr. Durgan, but I guess the answer is yes.
I'm flattered to have my grammar corrected by a man who's been on the bestseller lists, Durgan said, smiling.
The smile suggested that he'd like to see me sitting next to Romeo Bissonette in that first gulag-bound boxcar.
Tell us about your meeting, first with Kyra DeVore and then with Mary DeVore, or Maddie, if you like that better.
I told the story. When I was finished, Durgan centered the tape player in front of him. The nails of his pudgy fingers looked as glossy as his lips.
Mr. Noonan, you could have run Kyra over, isn't that true?
Absolutely not. I was going 35. That's the speed limit there by the store. I saw her in plenty of time to stop.
Suppose you had been coming the other way, though, heading north instead of south. Would you still have seen her in plenty of time?
That was a fairer question than some of his others, actually. Someone coming the other way would have had a far shorter time to react.
Still,
yes, I said.
Durgan went up with the eyebrows. You're sure of that?
Yes, Mr. Durgan. I might have had to come down a little harder on the brakes, but
at 35.
Yes, at 35. I told you, that's the speed limit.
On that particular stretch of Route 68. Yes, you told me that. You did.
Is it your experience that most people obey the speed limit on that part of the road?
I haven't spent much time on the TR since 1993, so I can't...
Come on, Mr. Noonan, this isn't a scene from one of your books. Just answer my questions, or we'll be here all morning.
I'm doing my best, Mr. Durgan.
He sighed, put upon.
You've owned your place on Darkscore Lake since the 80s, haven't you? And the speed limit around the Lakeview General Store, the post office, and Dick Brooks's all-purpose garage, what's called the North Village, hasn't changed since then, has it?
No, I admitted.
Returning to my original question, then. In your observation, do most people on that stretch of road obey the 35-mile-an-hour limit?
I can't say if it's most, because I've never done a traffic survey, but I guess a lot don't.
Would you like to hear Castle County Sheriff's Deputy Footman testify on where the greatest number of speeding tickets are given out in TR-90, Mr. Noonan?
No, I said, quite honestly.
Did other vehicles pass you while you were speaking first with Kyra DeVore and then with Mary DeVore?
Yes.
How many?
I don't know exactly. A couple.
Could it have been three?
I guess.
Five?
No, probably not so many.
But you don't know exactly, do you?
No.
Because Kyra DeVore was upset.
Actually, she had it together pretty well for...
Did she cry in your presence?
Well... Yes.
Did her mother make her cry?
That's unfair.
As unfair as allowing a 3-year-old to go strolling down the middle of a busy highway on a holiday morning, in your opinion, or perhaps not quite as unfair as that.
Jeepers, lay off, Mr. Bissonette said mildly. There was distress on his bloodhound's face.
I withdraw the question, Durgan said.
Which one? I asked.
He looked at me tiredly, as if to say he had to put up with assholes like me all the time, and he was used to how we behaved. How many cars went by from the time you picked the child up and carried her to safety to the time when you and the DeVores parted company? I hated that "carried her to safety" bit, but even as I formulated my answer, the old guy was muttering the question into his steno mask. And it was, in fact, what I had done. There was no getting around it. I told you I don't know for sure. Well, give me a guesstimate. Guesstimate. One of my all-time least favorite words. A Paul Harvey word. There might have been three. Including Mary DeVore herself driving a... He consulted the paper he'd taken from the folder. A 1982 Jeep Scout? I thought of Kai saying, "Maddie, go fast," and understood where Durgan was heading now, and there was nothing I could do about it. Yes, it was her, and it was a Scout. I don't know what year. Was she driving below the posted speed limit, at the posted speed limit, or above the posted speed limit when she passed the place where you were standing with Kyra in your arms? She'd been doing at least 50, but I told Durgan I couldn't say for sure. He urged me to try. "I know you are unfamiliar with the hangman's knot, Mr. Noonan, but I'm sure you can make one if you really work at it." And I declined as politely as I could. He picked up the paper again. "Mr. Noonan, would it surprise you to know that two witnesses, Richard Brooks Jr., the owner of Dick's All-Purpose Garage, and Royce Merrill, a retired carpenter, claim that Mrs. DeVore was doing well over 35 when she passed your location?" "I don't know," I said. "I was concerned with the little girl." "Would it surprise you to know that Royce Merrill estimated her speed at 60 miles an hour?" "That's ridiculous. When she hit the brakes, she would have skidded sideways and landed upside down in the ditch." "The skid marks measured by deputy footmen indicate a speed of at least 50 miles an hour," Durgan said. It wasn't a question, but he looked at me almost roguishly, as if inviting me to struggle a little more and sink a little deeper into this nasty pit. I said nothing. Durgan folded his pudgy little hands and leaned over them toward me. The roguish look was gone. "Mr. Noonan, if you hadn't carried Kyra DeVore to the side of the road, if you hadn't rescued her, might her own mother not have run her over?" Here was the really loaded question, and how should I answer it? Bissonette was certainly not flashing any helpful signals. He seemed to be trying to make meaningful eye contact with the pretty assistant. I thought of the book Maddie was reading in tandem with Bartleby, Silent Witness by Richard North Patterson. Unlike the Grisham brand, Patterson's lawyers almost always seemed to know what they were doing. "Objection, Your Honor. Calls for speculation on the part of the witness." I shrugged. "Sorry, Counselor, can't say. Left my crystal ball home." Again I saw the ugly flash in Durgan's eyes. "Mr. Noonan, I can assure you that if you don't answer that question here, you are apt to be called back from Malibu or Fire Island or wherever it is you're going to write your next opus to answer it later on." I shrugged. "If I am, I am. I've already told you I was concerned with the child. I can't tell you how fast the mother was going, or how good Royce Merrill's vision is, or if Deputy Footman even measured the right set of skid marks. There's a whole bunch of rubber on that part of the road, I can tell you. Suppose she was going 50. Even 55, let's say that. She's 20 years old, Durgan. At the age of 20, a person's driving skills are at their peak. She probably would have swerved around the child, and easily. I think that's quite enough. Why? Because you're not getting what you wanted?" Bissonette's shoe clipped my ankle again, but I ignored it. "If you're on Kyra's side, why do you sound as though you're on her grandfather's?" A baleful little smile touched Durgan's lips, the kind that says, "Okay, smart guy, you want to play?" He pulled the tape recorder a little closer to him. "Since you have mentioned Kyra's grandfather, Mr. Maxwell DeVore of Palm Springs, let's talk about him a little, shall we?"
"It's your show."
"Have you ever spoken with Maxwell DeVore?"
"Yes."
"In person or on the phone?"
"Phone." I thought about adding that he had somehow gotten hold of my unlisted number, then remembered that Maddie had done that too and decided to keep my mouth shut on that subject.
When was this?
Last Saturday night, the night of the 4th. He called while I was watching the fireworks.
And was the subject of your conversation that morning's little adventure?
As he asked, Durgan reached into his pocket and brought out a cassette tape. There was an ostentatious quality to this gesture. In that moment, he looked like a parlor magician showing you both sides of a silk handkerchief. And he was bluffing. I couldn't be sure of that, and yet I was. DeVore had taped our conversation all right. That underhum really had been too loud, and on some level, I'd been aware of that fact even while I was talking to him. And I thought it really was on the cassette Durgan was now slotting into the cassette player. But it was a bluff. I don't recall, I said. Durgan's hand froze in the act of snapping the cassette's transparent loading panel shut. He looked at me with frank disbelief. And something else. I thought that something else was surprised anger.
You don't recall? Come now, Mr. Noonan. Surely writers train themselves to recall conversations, and this one was only a week ago. Tell me what you talked about.
I really can't say, I told him in a stolid, colorless voice. For a moment, Durgan looked almost panicky. Then his features smoothed. One polished fingernail slipped back and forth over keys marked rewind, fast forward, play, and rec.
How did Mr. DeVore begin the conversation? He asked.
He said hello, I said mildly, and there was a short, muffled sound from behind the steno mask. It could have been the old guy clearing his throat. It could have been a suppressed laugh.
Spots of color were blooming in Durgan's cheeks. After hello, what then?
I don't recall.
Did he ask you about that morning?
I don't recall.
Didn't you tell him that Mary DeVore and her daughter were together, Mr. Noonan? That they were together picking flowers? Isn't that what you told this worried grandfather when he inquired about the incident which was the talk of the township that 4th of July?
Oh, boy, Bissonette said. He raised one hand over the table, then touched the palm with the fingers of the other, making a ref's tee.
Time out.
Durgan looked at him. The flush in his cheeks was more pronounced now, and his lips had pulled back enough to show the tips of small, neatly capped teeth.
What do you want? He almost snarled,
as if Bissonette had just dropped by to tell him about the Mormon Way or perhaps the Rosicrucians.
I want you to stop leading this guy, and I want that whole thing about picking flowers stricken from the record, Bissonette said.
Why? Durgan snapped.
Because you're trying to get stuff on the record that this witness won't say. If you want a break here for a while so we can make a conference call to Judge Rancourt, get his opinion,
I withdraw the question, Durgan said.
He looked at me with a kind of helpless, surly rage.
Mr. Noonan, do you want to help me do my job?
I want to help Kyra DeVore if I can, I said.
Very well.
He nodded as if no distinction had been made.
Then please tell me what you and Maxwell DeVore talked about.
I can't recall.
I caught his eyes and held them.
Perhaps, I said, you can refresh my recollection.
There was a moment of silence, like that which sometimes strikes a high-stakes poker game just after the last of the bets had been made and just before the players show their hands. Even the old fighter pilot was quiet, his eyes unblinking above the mask. Then Durgan pushed the cassette player aside with the heel of his hand. The set of his mouth said he felt about it just then as I often felt about the telephone, and went back to the morning of July 4th. He never asked about my dinner with Maddie and Kai on Tuesday night, and never returned to my telephone conversation with DeVore, the one where I had said all those awkward and easily disprovable things. I went on answering questions until 11:30, but the interview really ended when Durgan pushed the tape player away with the heel of his hand. I knew it, and I'm pretty sure he did, too.
Mike! Mike, over here! Maddie was waving from one of the tables in the picnic area behind the town commons bandstand. She looked vibrant and happy. I waved back and made my way in that direction, weaving between little kids playing tag, skirting a couple of teenagers making out on the grass, and ducking a frisbee which a German shepherd leaped up and caught smartly. There was a tall, skinny redhead with her, but I barely got a chance to notice him. Maddie met me while I was still on the gravel path, put her arms around me, hugged me. It was no prudy little ass-poking-out hug either. And then kissed me on the mouth hard enough to push my lips against my teeth. There was a hearty smack when she disengaged. She pulled back and looked at me with undisguised delight. "Was it the biggest kiss you've ever had?" "The biggest in at least 4 years," I said. "Will you settle for that?" And if she didn't step away from me in the next few seconds, she was going to have physical proof of how much I had enjoyed it. "I guess I'll have to." She turned to the red-headed guy with a funny kind of defiance. "Was that all right?" "Probably not," he said, "but at least you're not currently in view of those old boys at the all-purpose garage. Mike, I'm John Starrow. Nice to meet you in person." I liked him at once, maybe because I'd come upon him dressed in his three-piece New York suit and primly setting out paper plates on a picnic table, while his curly red hair blew around his head like kelp. His skin was fair and freckled, the kind which would never tan, only burn and then peel in great eczema-like patches. When we shook, his hand seemed to be all knuckles. He had to be at least 30, but he looked Maddie's age, and I guessed it would be another 5 years before he was able to get a drink without showing his driver's license. "Sit down," he said. "We've got a 5-course lunch, courtesy of Castle Rock Variety. Grinders, which are for some strange reason called Italian sandwiches up here, mozzarella sticks, garlic fries, Twinkies." "That's only 4, I said. "I forgot the soft drink course," he said, and pulled 3 long-neck bottles of S&OK Birch beer out of a brown bag. "Let's eat. Maddie runs the library from 2 to 8 on Fridays and Saturdays, and this would be a bad time for her to be missing work." "How did the reader's circle go last night?" I asked. "Lindy Briggs didn't eat you alive, I see." She laughed, clasped her hands, and shook them over her head. "I was a hit, an absolute smashola. I didn't dare tell them I got all my best insights from you." "Thank God for small favors," Starrow said. He was freeing his own sandwich from its string and butcher paper wrapping, doing it carefully and a little dubiously, using just the tips of his fingers. "So I said I looked in a couple of books and found some leads there. It was sort of wonderful. I felt like a college kid."
"Good."
"Bissonette?" John Starrow asked. "Where's he? I never met a guy named Romeo before."
"Said he had to go right back to Lewiston. Sorry."
"Actually, it's best we stay small, at least to begin with." He bit into his sandwich, they come tucked into long sub-rolls, and looked at me, surprised. "This isn't bad." "Eat more than 3, and you're hooked for life," Maddie said, and chomped heartily into her own. "Tell us about the depot," John said, and while they ate, I talked. When I finished, I picked up my own sandwich and played a little catch-up. I'd forgotten how good an Italian can be. Sweet, sour, and oily all at the same time. Of course, nothing that tastes that good can be healthy, that's a given. I suppose one could formulate a similar postulate about full-body hugs from young girls in legal trouble.
"Very interesting," John said. "Very interesting indeed."
He took a mozzarella stick from its grease-stained bag, broke it open, and looked with a kind of fascinated horror at the clotted white gunk inside.
"People up here eat this?" he asked.
"People in New York eat fish bladders," I said. "Raw."
"I suppose so."
He dipped a piece into the plastic container of spaghetti sauce. In this context, it is called cheese dip in Western Maine. Then ate it.
"Well?" I asked.
"Not bad. They ought to be a lot hotter, though." Yes, he was right about that. Eating cold mozzarella sticks is a little like eating cold snot, an observation I thought I would keep to myself on this beautiful midsummer Friday. If Durgan had the tape,
Why wouldn't he play it? Maddie asked. I don't understand.
John stretched his arms out, cracked his knuckles, and looked at her benignly.
We'll probably never know for sure, he said.
He thought DeVore was going to drop the suit. It was in every line of his body language and every inflection of his voice. That was hopeful, but it would be good if Maddie didn't allow herself to become too hopeful. John Starrow wasn't as young as he looked, and probably not as guileless either, or so I fervently hoped, but he was young, and neither he nor Maddie knew the story of Scooter Larrabee's sled, or had seen Bill Dean's face when he told it.
Want to hear some possibilities?
Sure, I said. John put down his sandwich, wiped his fingers, and then began to tick off points. First, he made the call. Taped conversations have a highly dubious value under those circumstances. Second, he didn't exactly come off as Captain Kangaroo, did he?
No.
Third, your fabrication impugns you, Mike, but not really very much, and it doesn't impugn Maddie at all. And by the way, that thing about Maddie pushing bubbles in Kyra's face, I love that. If that's the best they can do, they better give it up right now. Last, and this is where the truth probably lies, I think DeVore's got Nixon's disease.
Nixon's disease? Maddie asked.
The tape Durgan had isn't the only tape. Can't be. And your father-in-law is afraid that if he introduces one tape made by whatever system he's got in Warrington's, we might subpoena all of them. And I'd damn well try.
She looked bewildered. What could be on them? And if it's bad, why not just destroy them?
Maybe he can't, I said. Maybe he needs them for other reasons.
It doesn't really matter, John said. Durgan was bluffing, and that's what matters.
He hit the heel of his hand lightly against the picnic table. I think he's going to drop it. I really do.
It's too early to start thinking like that, I said at once. But I could tell by Maddie's face, shining more brightly than ever, that the damage was done.
Fill him in on what else you've been doing, Maddie told John. Then I've got to get to the library.
Where do you send Kyra on your work days? I asked.
Mrs. Cullum's. She lives 2 miles up the Wasp Hill Road. Also in July, there's VBS from 10 until 3. That's Vacation Bible School. Kai loves it, especially the singing and the flannel board stories about Noah and Moses. The bus drops her off at Arlene's, and I pick her up around 9:15. She smiled a little wistfully. By then, she's usually fast asleep on the couch.
John held forth for the next 10 minutes or so. He hadn't been on the case long, but it already started a lot of balls rolling. A fellow in California was gathering facts about Roger DeVore and Morris Ridding. Gathering facts sounded so much better than snooping.
John was particularly interested in learning about the quality of Roger DeVore's relations with his father, and if Roger was on record concerning his little niece from Maine. John had also mapped out a campaign to learn as much as possible about Max DeVore's movements and activities since coming back to TR-90. To that end, he had the name of a private investigator, one recommended by Romeo Bissonette, my rent lawyer. As he spoke, paging rapidly through a little notebook he drew from the inside pocket of his suit coat, I remembered what he'd said about Lady Justice during our telephone conversation.
Slap some handcuffs on that broad's wrist to go along with the blindfold, rape her, and roll her in the mud.
That was maybe a bit too strong for what we were doing, but I thought at the very least we were shoving her around a little. I imagined poor Roger DeVore up on the stand, having flown 3,000 miles in order to be questioned about his sexual preferences. I had to keep reminding myself that his father had put him in that position, not Maddie or me or John Starrow.
Have you gotten any closer to a meeting with DeVore and his chief legal advisor? I asked.
Don't know for sure. The line is in the water, the offer on the table, the puck's on the ice, pick your favorite metaphor, mix 'em and match 'em if you desire.
Got your irons in the fire, Maddie said solemnly.
Your checker's on the board, I added.
We looked at each other and laughed. John regarded us sadly, then sighed, picked up his sandwich, and began to eat again.
You really have to meet him with his lawyer more or less dancing attendance? I asked.
Would you like to win this thing, then discover DeVore can do it all again based on unethical behavior by Mary DeVore's legal resource? John returned.
Don't even joke about it, Maddie cried.
I wasn't joking, John said. It has to be with his lawyer, yes. I don't think it's going to happen, not on this trip. I haven't even got a look at the old caca, and I have to tell you my curiosity is killing me.
If that's all it takes to make you happy, show up behind the backstop at the softball field next Tuesday evening, Maddie said.
He'll be there in his fancy wheelchair, laughing and clapping and sucking his damned old oxygen every 15 minutes or so.
Not a bad idea, John said. I have to go back to New York for the weekend. I'm leaving Après Osgood. But maybe I'll show up on Tuesday. I might even bring my glove.
He began clearing up our litter, and once again I thought he looked both prissy and endearing at the same time, like Stan Laurel wearing an apron. Maddie eased him aside and took over.
No one ate any Twinkies, she said a little sadly.
Take them home to your daughter, John said.
No way. I don't let her eat stuff like this. What kind of mother do you think I am?
She saw our expressions, replayed what she'd just said, then burst out laughing. We joined her. Maddie's old scout was parked in one of the slant spaces behind the war memorial, which in Castle Rock is a World War I soldier with a generous helping of bird shit on his pie dish helmet. A brand new Taurus with a Hertz decal above the inspection sticker was parked next to it. John tossed his briefcase, reassuringly thin and not very ostentatious, into the back seat.
If I can make it back on Tuesday, I'll call you, he told Maddie. If I'm able to get an appointment with your father-in-law through this man Osgood, I will also call you.
I'll buy the Italian sandwiches, Maddie said.
He smiled, then grasped her arm in one hand and mine in the other. He looked like a newly ordained minister getting ready to marry his first couple.
You two talk on the telephone if you need to, he said, always remembering that one or both lines may be tapped. Meet in the market if you happen to. Mike, you might feel a need to drop by the local library and check out a book.
Not until you renew your card, though, Maddie said, giving me a demure glance.
But no more visits to Maddie's trailer. Is that understood?
I said yes. She said yes. John Starrow looked unconvinced. It made me wonder if he was seeing something in our faces or bodies that shouldn't be there.
They are committed to a line of attack which probably isn't going to work, he said. We can't risk giving them the chance to change course. That means innuendos about the two of you. It also means innuendos about Mike and Kyra.
Maddie's shocked expression made her look 12 again.
Mike and Kyra? What are you talking about?
Allegations of child molestation thrown up by people so desperate they'll try anything.
That's ridiculous, she said, and if my father-in-law wanted to sling that kind of mud...
John nodded.
Yes, we'd be obliged to sling it right back. Newspaper coverage from coast to coast would follow, maybe even court TV, God bless and save us. We want none of that if we can avoid it. It's not good for the grown-ups, and it's not good for the child. Now or later...
He bent and kissed Maddie's cheek.
I'm sorry about all this, he said, and he did sound genuinely sorry. Custody's just this way.
I think you warned me. It's just that the idea someone might make a thing like that up just because there was no other way for them to win.
Let me warn you again, he said. His face came as close to grim as its young and good-natured features would probably allow. What we have is a very rich man with a very shaky case. The combination could be like working with old dynamite.
I turned to Maddie. Are you still worried about Kai? Still feel she's in danger?
I saw her think about hedging her response, out of plain old Yankee reserve, quite likely, and then deciding not to. Deciding, perhaps, that hedging was a luxury she couldn't afford.
Yes. But it's just a feeling, you know.
John was frowning. I suppose the idea that DeVore might resort to extra-legal means of obtaining what he wanted had occurred to him as well.
Keep your eye on her as much as you can,
he said. I respect intuition. Is yours based on anything concrete?
No, Maddie answered, and her quick glance in my direction asked me to keep my mouth shut.
Not really.
She opened the scout's door and tossed in the little brown bag with the Twinkies in it. She had decided to keep them after all. Then she turned to John and me with an expression that was close to anger. I'm not sure how to follow that advice anyway. I work 5 days a week, and in August, when we do the microfiche update, it'll be 6. Right now, Kai gets her lunch at Vacation Bible School and her dinner from Arlene Cullen. I see her in the morning. The rest of the time... I knew what she was going to say before she said it. The expression was an old one. She's on the TR.
I could help you find an au pair, I said, thinking it would be a hell of a lot cheaper than John Starrow.
No, they said in such perfect unison that they glanced at each other and laughed. But even while she was laughing, Maddie looked tense and unhappy.
We're not going to leave a paper trail for Durgan or DeVore's custody team to exploit, John said. Who pays me is one thing. Who pays Maddie's childcare help is another.
Besides, I've taken enough from you, Maddie said, more than I can sleep easy on. I'm not going to get in any deeper just because I've been having megrims.
She climbed into the scout and closed the door. I rested my hands on her open window. Now we were on the same level, and the eye contact was so strong it was disconcerting.
Maddie, I don't have anything else to spend it on.
Really?
When it comes to John's fee, I accept that, because John's fee is about Kai.
She put her hand over mine and squeezed briefly. This other is about me.
All right?
Yeah, but you need to tell your babysitter and the people who run this Bible thing that you've got a custody case on your hands. A potentially bitter one, and Kyra's not to go anywhere with anyone, even someone they know, without your say-so.
She smiled. It's already been done, on John's advice. Stay in touch, Mike.
She lifted my hand, gave it a hearty smack, and drove away.
What do you think? I asked John as we watched the scout blow oil on its way to the new Prouty Bridge, which spans Castle Stream and spills outbound traffic onto Highway 68.
I think she's lucky to have a well-heeled benefactor and a smart lawyer, John said.
He paused, then added, but I'll tell you something. She somehow doesn't feel lucky to me at all.
There's a feeling I get.
I don't know.
That there's a cloud around her you can't quite see.
Maybe. Maybe that's it.
He raked his hands through the restless mass of his red hair. I just know it's something sad. I knew exactly what he meant. Except for me, there was more. I wanted to be in bed with her, sad or not, right or not. I wanted to feel her hands on me, tugging and pressing, patting and stroking. I wanted to be able to smell her skin and taste her hair. I wanted to have her lips against my ear, her breath tickling the fine hairs within its cup, as she told me to do what I wanted, whatever I wanted.
I got back to Sarah Laughs shortly before 2 o'clock and let myself in, thinking about nothing but my study and the IBM with the courier ball. I was writing again. Writing. I could still hardly believe it. I'd work, not that it felt much like work after a 4-year layoff, until maybe 6 o'clock, swim, then go down to the Village Cafe for one of Buddy's cholesterol-rich specialties. The moment I stepped through the door, Bunter's bell began to ring stridently. I stopped in the foyer, my hand frozen on the knob. The house was hot and bright, not a shadow anywhere, but the goose flesh forming on my arms felt like midnight. "Who's here?" I called. The bell stopped ringing. There was a moment of silence, and then a woman shrieked. It came from everywhere, pouring out of the sunny, moat-laden air like sweat out of hot skin. It was a scream of outrage, anger, grief, but mostly, I think,
of horror, and I screamed in response. I couldn't help it. I had been frightened standing in the dark cellar stairwell, listening to the unseen fist thump on the insulation, but this was far worse. It never stopped, that scream. It faded as the child's sobs had faded. Faded as if the person screaming was being carried rapidly down a long corridor and away from me. At last it was gone. I leaned against the bookcase, my palm pressed against my t-shirt, my heart galloping beneath it. I was gasping for breath, and my muscles had that queer exploded feel they get after you've had a bad scare. A minute passed. My heartbeat gradually slowed, and my breathing slowed with it. I straightened up, took a tottery step, and when my legs held me, took two more. I stood in the kitchen doorway, looking across to the living room. Above the fireplace, Bunter the Moose looked glassily back at me. The bell around his neck hung still and chimeless. A hot sun point glowed on its side. The only sound was that stupid Felix the Cat clock in the kitchen. The thought nagging at me, even then, was that the screaming woman had been Joe, that Sarah Laughs was being haunted by my wife, and that she was in pain. Dead or not, she was in pain. Joe? I asked quietly. Joe, are you? The sobbing began again, the sound of a terrified child. At the same moment, my mouth and nose once more filled with the iron taste of the lake. I put one hand to my throat, gagging and frightened, then leaned over the sink and spat. It was as it had been before. Instead of voiding a huge gush of water, nothing came out but a little spit. The waterlogged feeling was gone as if it had never been there. I stayed where I was, grasping the counter and bent over the sink, probably looking like a drunk who has finished the party by upchucking most of the night's bottled cheer. I felt like that, too, stunned and bleary, too overloaded to really understand what was going on. At last I straightened up again, took the towel folded over the dishwasher's handle and wiped my face with it. There was tea in the fridge, and I wanted a tall, ice-choked glass of it in the worst way. I reached for the door handle and froze. The fruit and vegetable magnets were drawn into a circle again. In the center was this. Help, I'm drowned. That's it, I thought. I'm getting out of here, right now, today. Yet an hour later, I was up in my stifling study with a glass of tea on the desk beside me, the cubes in it long since melted, dressed only in my bathing suit and lost in the world I was making, the one where a private detective named Andy Drake was trying to prove that John Shackelford was not the serial killer nicknamed Baseball Cap. This is how we go on, one day at a time, one meal at a time. One pain at a time, one breath at a time. Dentists go on one root canal at a time. Boat builders go on one hull at a time. If you write books, you go on one page at a time. We turn from all we know and all we fear. We study catalogs, watch football games, choose Sprint over AT&T. We count the birds in the sky and will not turn from the window when we hear the footsteps behind us as something comes up the hall. We say, yes, I agree that clouds often look like other things, fish and unicorns and men on horseback, but they are really only clouds. Even when the lightning flashes inside them, we say they are only clouds and turn our attention to the next meal, the next pain, the next breath, the next page. This is how we go on. The book was big, okay? The book was major. I was afraid to change rooms, let alone pack up the typewriter in my slim, just-begun manuscript and take it back to Derry. That would be as dangerous as taking an infant out into a windstorm. So I stayed, always reserving the right to move out if things got too weird, the way smokers reserve the right to quit if their coughs get too heavy. And a week passed. Things happened during that week. But until I met Max DeVore on the street the following Friday, the 17th of July it would have been, the most important thing was that I continued to work on a novel which would, if finished, be called My Childhood Friend. Perhaps we always think what was lost was the best, or would have been the best. I don't know for sure. What I do know is that my real life that week had mostly to do with Andy Drake, John Shackelford, and a shadowy figure standing in the deep background. Raymond Garrity, John Shackelford's childhood friend, a man who sometimes wore a baseball cap. During that week, the manifestations in the house continued, but at a lower level. There was nothing like that blood-curdling scream. Sometimes Bunter's bell rang. Sometimes the fruit and vegetable magnets would reform themselves into a circle. Never with words in the middle, though. Not that week. One morning I got up and the sugar canister was overturned, making me think of Maddie's story about the flower. Nothing was written in the spill, but there was a squiggle, as though something had tried to write and failed. If so, I sympathized. I knew what that was like. My depot before the redoubtable Elmer Durgan was on Friday the 14th. On the following Tuesday, I took the street down to Warrington's softball field, hoping for my own peek at Max DeVore. It was going on 6 o'clock when I got within hearing range of the shouts, cheers, and batted balls. A path marked with rustic signs, curlicued W's burned into oak arrows, led past the abandoned boathouse, a couple of sheds, and a gazebo half-buried in blackberry creepers. I eventually came out in deep center field. A litter of potato chip bags, candy wrappers, and beer cans suggested that others sometimes watched the games from this vantage point. I couldn't help thinking about Joe and her mysterious friend, the guy in the old brown sport coat, the burly guy who had slipped an arm around her waist and led her away from the game, laughing, back toward the street. Twice over the weekend I'd come close to calling Bonnie a Mudson, seeing if maybe I could chase that guy down, put a name on him, and both times I had backed off. Sleeping dogs, I told myself each time. Sleeping dogs, Michael. I had the area beyond deep center to myself that evening, and it felt like the right distance from home plate, considering the man who usually parked his wheelchair behind the backstop had called me a liar, and I had invited him to store my telephone number where the sunshine grows dim. I needn't have worried in any case. DeVore wasn't in attendance, nor was the lovely Roguette. I did spot Maddie behind the casually maintained chicken wire barrier on the first baseline. John Starrow was beside her, wearing jeans and a polo shirt, his red hair mostly corralled by a Mets cap. They stood watching the game and chatting like old friends for 2 innings before they saw me. More than enough time for me to feel envious of John's position, and a little jealous as well. Finally, someone lofted a long fly to center, where the edge of the woods served as the only fence. The center fielder backed up, but it was going to be far over his head. It was hit to my depth, off to my right. I moved in that direction without thinking, high-footing through the shrubs that formed a zone between the mown outfield and the trees, hoping I wasn't running through poison ivy. I caught the softball in my outstretched left hand and laughed when some of the spectators cheered. The center fielder applauded me by tapping his bare right hand into the pocket of his glove. The batter, meanwhile, circled the bases serenely, knowing he had hit a ground rule home run. I tossed the ball to the fielder, and as I returned to my original post among the candy wrappers and beer cans, I looked back in and saw Maddie and John looking at me. If anything confirms the idea that we're just one more species of animal, one with a slightly bigger brain and a much bigger idea of our own importance in the scheme of things, it's how much we can convey by gesture when we absolutely have to. Maddie clasped her hands to her chest, tilted her head to the left, raised her eyebrows. My hero. I held my hands to my shoulders and flipped the palms skyward. Shucks, ma'am, 'twarn't nothing. John lowered his head and put his fingers to his brow as if something there hurt. You lucky son of a bitch. With those comments out of the way, I pointed at the backstop and shrugged a question. Both Maddie and John shrugged back. An inning later, a little boy who looked like one giant exploding freckle ran out to where I was, his oversized Michael Jordan jersey churning around his shins like a dress.
Guy down there give me 50 cents to say you should call him later on at his hotel over in the Rock, he said, pointing at John. He say you'd give me another 50 cents if there was an answer.
Tell him I'll call him around 9:30, I said. I don't have any change, though. Can you take a buck?
Hey, yeah, swank.
He snatched it, turned away, then turned back. He grinned, revealing a set of teeth caught between Act One and Act Two. With the softball players in the background, he looked like a Norman Rockwell archetype.
Guy also say to tell you that was a bullshit catch.
Tell him people used to say the same thing about Willie Mays all the time.
Willie who?
Ah, you. Ah, Maurice. Just tell him, son. He'll know. I stayed another inning, but by then the game was getting drunk, DeVore still hadn't shown, and I went back home the way I had come. I met one fisherman standing out on a rock and two young people strolling along the street toward Warrington's, their hands linked. They said hi, and I hied them back. I felt lonely and content at the same time. I believe that is a rare kind of happiness. Some people check their phone answering machines when they get home. That summer, I always checked the front of the fridge. Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny, as Bullwinkle Moose used to say, the spirits are about to speak. That night they hadn't, although the fruit and vegetable magnets had reformed into a sinuous shape like a snake or perhaps the letter S taking a nap. A little later, I called John and asked him where DeVore had been, and he repeated in words what he had already told me, and much more economically by gesture.
It's the first game he's missed since he came back, he said. Maddie tried asking a few people if he was okay, and the consensus seemed to be that he was, at least as far as anyone knew.
What do you mean she tried asking a few people?
I mean that several wouldn't even talk to her. Cut her dead, my parents' generation would have said.
Watch it, buddy, I thought, but didn't say. That's only half a step from my generation.
One of her old girlfriends spoke to her finally, but there's a general attitude about Maddie DeVore. That man Osgood may be a shitty realtor, but as DeVore's Mr. Money Guy, he's doing a wonderful job of separating Maddie from the other folks in the town.
Is it a town, Mike? I don't quite get that part.
It's just the TR, I said absently. There's no real way to explain it.
Do you really believe DeVore's bribing everyone? That doesn't say much for the good old Wordsworthian idea of pastoral innocence and goodness, does it?
He's spreading money and using Osgood, maybe Footman too, to spread stories. And the folks around here seem at least as honest politicians.
The ones who stay bought?
Yeah. Oh, and I saw one of DeVore's potential star witnesses in the case of the runaway child, Royce Merrill. He was over by the equipment shed with some of his cronies. Did you happen to notice him?
I said I had not.
Guy must be 130, John said. He's got a cane with a gold head the size of an elephant's asshole.
That's a Boston Post cane. The oldest person in the area gets to keep it.
And I have no doubt he came by it honestly. If DeVore's lawyers put him on the stand, I'll debone him.
There was something chilling in John's gleeful confidence.
I'm sure, I said. How did Maddie take getting cut dead by her old friends?
I was thinking of her saying that she hated Tuesday nights, hated to think of the softball games going on as they always had at the field where she had met her late husband.
She did okay, John said. I think she's given most of them up as a lost cause anyway.
I had my doubts about that. I seemed to remember that at 20, lost causes are sort of a specialty, but I didn't say anything.
She's hanging in. She's been lonely and scared. I think that in her own mind, she might already have begun the process of giving Kyra up. But she's got her confidence back now, mostly thanks to meeting you. Talk about your fantastically lucky breaks.
Well, maybe. I flashed on Joe's brother Frank once saying to me that he didn't think there was any such thing as luck, only fate and inspired choices. And then I remembered that image of the TR crisscrossed with invisible cables, connections that were unseen but as strong as steel. John, I forgot to ask the most important question of all the other day after I gave my depot. This custody case we're all so concerned about, has it even been scheduled? Good question. I've checked three ways to Sunday, and Bissonette has too. Unless DeVore and his people have pulled something really slippery, like filing in another court district, I don't think it has been. Could they do that? File in another district? Maybe, but probably not without us finding out. So what does it mean? That DeVore's on the verge of giving up, John said promptly. As of now, I see no other way of explaining it. I'm going back to New York first thing tomorrow, but I'll stay in touch. If anything comes up here, you do the same. I said I would and went to bed. No female visitors came to share my dreams. That was sort of a relief. When I came downstairs to recharge my iced tea glass late Wednesday morning, Brenda Meserve had erected the laundry whirligig on the back stoop and was hanging out my clothes. This she did, as her mother had no doubt taught her, with pants and shirts on the outside and undies on the inside, where any passing nosy parkers couldn't see what you chose to wear closest to your skin. "You can take these in around 4 o'clock, Mrs. M said as she prepared to leave. She looked at me with the bright and cynical eye of a woman who has been doing for well-off men her entire life. "Don't you forget and leave them out all night. Dewy clothes don't ever feel fresh until they're washed again." I told her most humbly that I would remember to take in my clothes. I then asked her, feeling like a spy working an embassy party for information, if the house felt all right to her. "All right how?" she asked, cocking one wild eyebrow at me. "Well, I've heard funny noises a couple of times. In the night." She sniffed. "It's a log house, ain't it? Built in relays, so to speak. It settles one wing against t'other. That's what you hear, most likely." "No ghosts, huh?" I said, as if disappointed. "Not that I've ever seen," she said, as matter-of-fact as an accountant. "But my ma said there's plenty down here. She said this whole lake is haunted. By the Micmacs that lived here until they were driven out by General Wing, by all the men who went away to the Civil War and died there. Over 600 went from this part of the world, Mr. Noonan, and less than 150 came back, at least, in their bodies. Ma said this side of Dark Score is also haunted by the ghost of that Negro boy who died here, poor tyke. He belonged to one of the Red Tops, you know." "No. I know about Sarah and the Red Tops, but not this." I paused. "Did he drown?" "Nope. Caught in an animal trap. Struggled there for most of a whole day, screaming for help. Finally, they found him. They saved the foot, but they shouldn't have. Blood poisoning set in, and the boy died. Summer of '01, that was. It's why they left, I guess. It was too sad to stay. But my ma used to claim the little fella. He stayed. She used to say that he's still on the TR. I wondered what Mrs. M would say if I told her that the little fella had very likely been here to greet me when I arrived from Derry and had been back on several occasions since. "Then there was Kenny Oster's father, Normal," she said. "You know that story, don't you?" "Oh, that's a terrible story." She looked rather pleased, either at knowing such a terrible story or at having the chance to tell it. "No," I said. "I know Kenny, though. He's the one with the wolfhound, Blueberry."
"Yeah, he carpenters a tad and caretakes a tad, just like his father before him. His dad caretook many of these places, you know, and back just after the Second World War was over, Norma Oster drowned Kenny's little brother in his backyard. This was when they lived on Wasp Hill, down where the road splits, one side going to the old butt landing and the other to the marina. He didn't drown the tyke in the lake, though. He put him on the ground under the pump and just held him there until the baby was full of water and dead."
I stood there looking at her, the clothes behind us snapping on their whirligig. I thought of my mouth and nose and throat full of that cold mineral taste that could have been well water as well as lake water. Down here, all of it comes from the same deep aquifers. I thought of the message on the refrigerator. Help, I'm drowned.
He left the baby laying right under the pump. He had a new Chevrolet, and he drove it down here to Lane 42. Took his shotgun, too.
You aren't going to tell me Kenny Oster's dad committed suicide in my house, are you, Mrs. Mazur?
She shook her head. Nope. He did it on the Bricker's lakeside deck. Sat down on their porch glider and blew his damn baby-murdering head off.
The Brickers?
I don't. You wouldn't. Hasn't been any Brickers on the lake since the 60s. They were from Delaware. Quality folks. You'd think of it as the Washburn place, I guess, although they're gone now, too. Place is empty. Every now and then that stock, natural-born fool Osgood brings someone down and shows it off, but he'll never sell it at the price he's asking, mark my words.
The Washburns I had known had played bridge with them a time or two. Nice enough people, although probably not what Mrs. M., with her queer backcountry snobbishness, would have called quality. Their place was maybe an eighth of a mile north of mine along the street. Past that point, there's nothing much. The drop to the lake gets steep, and the woods are massed tangles of second growth and blackberry bushes. The street goes on to the tip of Halo Bay at the far north end of Dark Score, but once Lane 42 curves back to the highway, it is for the most part used only by berry-picking expeditions in the summer and hunters in the fall. Normal, I thought. Hell of a name for a guy who had drowned his infant son under the backyard pump. Did he leave a note? Any explanation?
Nope. But you'll hear folks say he haunts the lake, too. Little towns are most likely full of haunts, but I couldn't say I know or maybe myself. I ain't the sensitive type. All I know about your place, Mr. Noonan, is that it smells damp no matter how much I try to get it aired out. I imagine that's logs. Log buildings don't go well with lakes. The damp gets into the wood.
She had set her purse down between her Reeboks. Now she bent and picked it up. It was a countrywoman's purse, black, styleless, except for the gold grommets holding the handles on, and utilitarian. She could have carried a good selection of kitchen appliances in there if she had wanted to.
I can't stand here nattering all day long, though. Much as I might like to, I got one more place to go before I can call it quits. Summer's harvest time in this part of the world, you know. Now remember to take those clothes in before dark, Mr. Noonan. Don't let them get all dewy.
I won't, and I didn't. But when I went back out to take them in, dressed in my bathing suit and coated with sweat from the oven I'd been working in, I had to get the air conditioner fixed, just had to. I saw that something had altered Mrs. M's arrangements. My jeans and shirts now hung around the pole. The underwear and socks, which had been decorously hidden when Mrs. M drove up the driveway in her old Ford, were now on the outside. It was as if my unseen guest, one of my unseen guests, was saying, ha, ha, ha. I went to the library the next day and made renewing my library card my first order of business. Lindy Briggs herself took my $4 and entered me into the computer, first telling me how sorry she had been to hear about Joe's death. And, as with Bill, I sensed a certain reproach in her tone, as if I were to blame for such improperly delayed condolences. I supposed I was. Lindy, do you have a town history, I asked, when we had finished the proprieties concerning my wife. We have two, she said, then leaned toward me over the desk, a little woman in a violently patterned sleeveless dress, her hair a gray puffball around her head, her bright eyes swimming behind her bifocals. In a confidential voice, she added, neither is much good.
Which one is better? I asked, matching her tone.
Probably the one by Edward Osteen. He was a summer resident until the mid-50s and lived here full-time when he retired. He wrote Dark Scored Days in 1965 or 66. He had it privately published because he couldn't find a commercial house that would take it. Even the regional publishers passed. She sighed. The locals bought it, but that's not many books, is it?
No, I suppose not, I said.
He just wasn't much of a writer. Not much of a photographer, either. Those little black-and-white snaps of his make my eyes hurt. Still, he tells some good stories. The Micmac Drive, General Wing's Trick Horse, the Twister in the 1880s, the fires in the 1930s.
Anything about Sarah and the Red Tops?
She nodded, smiling. Finally got around to looking up the history of your own place, did you? I'm glad to hear it. He found an old photo of them, and it's in there. He thought it was taken at the Freiburg Fair in 1900. Ed used to say he'd give a lot to hear a record made by that bunch.
So would I, but none were ever made.
A haiku by the Greek poet George Sepharis suddenly occurred to me. Are these the voices of our dead friends, or just the gramophone? What happened to Mr. Osteen? I don't recall the name. Died not a year or two before you and Joe bought your place on the lake, she said. Cancer.
You said there were two histories?
The other one you probably know, a history of Castle County and Castle Rock, done for the county centennial and dry as dust. Eddie Osteen's book isn't very well written, but he wasn't dry. You have to give him that much. You should find them both over there. She pointed to shelves with a sign over them which read, Of Main Interest. They don't circulate. Then she brightened. Although we will happily take any nickels you should feel moved to feed into our photocopy machine. Maddie was sitting in the far corner next to a boy in a turned-around baseball cap, showing him how to use the microfilm reader. She looked up at me, smiled, and mouthed the words, Nice catch, referring to my lucky grab at Warrington's, presumably. I gave a modest little shrug before turning to the Of Main Interest shelves. But she was right. Lucky or not, it had been a nice catch.
What are you looking for?
I was so deep in the two histories I'd found that Maddie's voice made me jump. I turned around and smiled, first aware that she was wearing some light and pleasant perfume, second that Lindy Briggs was watching us from the main desk, her welcoming smile put away. Background on the area where I live, I said. Old stories. My housekeeper got me interested. Then, in a lower voice, teachers watching. Don't look around. Maddie looked startled, and, I thought, a little worried. As it turned out, she was right to be worried. In a voice that was low-pitched yet still designed to carry at least as far as the desk, she asked if she could reshelve either book for me. I gave her both. As she picked them up, she said in what was almost a Con's whisper, That lawyer who represented you last Friday got John a private detective. He says they may have found something interesting about the guardian ad litem. I walked over to the Of Main Interest shelves with her, hoping I wasn't getting her in trouble, and asked if she knew what the something interesting might be. She shook her head, gave me a professional little librarian smile, and I went away. On the ride back to the house, I tried to think about what I'd read, but there wasn't much. Osteen was a bad writer who had taken bad pictures, and while his stories were colorful, they were also pretty thin on the ground. He mentioned Sarah and the Red Tops, all right, but he referred to them as a Dixieland octet, and even I knew that wasn't right. The Red Tops might have played some Dixieland, but they had primarily been a blues group, Friday and Saturday nights, and a gospel group, Sunday mornings and afternoons. Osteen's two-page summary of the Red Top's stay on the TR made it clear that he had heard no one else's covers of Sarah's tunes. He confirmed that a child had died of blood poisoning caused by a trap-hold wound, a story which sounded like Brenda Meserve's, but why wouldn't it? Osteen had likely heard it from Mrs. M's father or grandfather. He also said that the boy was Son Tidwell's only child and that the guitar player's real name had been Reginald Tidwell. The Tidwells had supposedly drifted north from the whorehouse district of New Orleans, the fabled crib and club streets which had been known around the turn of the century as Storyville. There was no mention of Sarah and the Red Tops in the more formal history of Castle County, and no mention of Kenny Auster's drowned little brother in either book. Not long before Maddie came over to speak to me, I'd had a wild idea that Son Tidwell and Sarah Tidwell were man and wife, and that the little boy, not named by Osteen, had been their son. I found the picture Lindy had mentioned and studied it closely. It showed at least a dozen black people standing in a stiff group in front of what looked like a cattle exhibition. There was an old-fashioned Ferris wheel in the background. It could well have been taken at the Freiburg Fair, and as old and faded as it was, it had a simple, elemental power that all Osteen's own photos put together could not match. You have seen photographs of Western and Depression-era bandidos that have that same look of eerie truth, stern faces above tight ties and collars, eyes not quite lost in the shadows of antique hat brims. Sarah stood front and center, wearing a black dress and her guitar. She was not outright smiling in this picture, but there seemed to be a smile in her eyes, and I thought they were like the eyes in some paintings, the ones that seemed to follow you wherever you moved in the room. I studied the photo and thought of her almost spiteful voice in my dream. "What do you want to know, sugar?" I suppose I wanted to know about her and the others, who they had been, what they were to each other when they weren't singing and playing, why they'd left, where they'd gone. Both of her hands were clearly visible, one posed on the strings of her guitar, the other on the frets, where she had been making a G chord on an October day in the year 1900. Her fingers were long, artistic, bare of rings. That didn't necessarily mean that she and Son Tidwell weren't married, of course, and even if they hadn't been, the little boy who'd been caught in the trap could have been born on the wrong side of the blanket. Except the same ghost of a smile lurked in Son Tidwell's eyes. The resemblance was remarkable. I had an idea that the two of them had been brother and sister, not man and wife. I thought about these things on my way home, and I thought about cables that were felt rather than seen. But mostly, I found myself thinking about Lindy Briggs, the way she had smiled at me, the way, a little later on, she had not smiled at her bright young librarian with the high school certification. That worried me. Then I got back to the house, and all I worried about was my story and the people in it, bags of bones which were putting on flesh daily. Michael Noonan, Max DeVore, and Rogette Whitmore played out their horrible little comedy scene Friday evening. Two other things which bear narrating happened before that. The first was a call from John Storrow on Thursday night. I was sitting in front of the TV with a baseball game running soundlessly in front of me. The mute button, with which most remote controls come equipped, may be the 20th century's finest invention. I was thinking about Sarah Tidwell and Son Tidwell and Son Tidwell's little boy. I was thinking about Storyville, a name any writer just had to love. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking about my wife, who had died pregnant. "Hello," I said. "Mike, I have some wonderful news," John said. He sounded near to bursting. "Romeo Bissonette may be a weird name, but there's nothing weird about the detective guy he found for me. His name is George Kennedy, like the actor. He's good, and he's fast. This guy could work in New York." "If that's the highest compliment you can think of, you need to get out of the city more." He went on as if he hadn't heard. "Kennedy's real job is with a security firm. The other stuff is strictly in the moonlight, which is a great loss, believe me. He got most of this on the phone. I can't believe it." "What specifically can't you believe?" "Jackpot, baby." Again, he spoke in that tone of greedy satisfaction, which I found both troubling and reassuring. "Elmer Durgan has done the following things since late May. Paid off his car, paid off his camp in Rangeley Lakes, caught up on about 90 years of child support. Nobody pays child support for 90 years, I said, but I was just running my mouth to hear it go, to let off some of my own building excitement and truth. "'Tain't possible, McGee."
"It is if you have 7 kids," John said, and began howling with laughter.
I thought of the pudgy, self-satisfied face, the cupid bow mouth, the nails that looked polished and prissy.
"He don't," I said.
"He do," John said, still laughing. He sounded like a complete lunatic, manic, hold the depressive.
"He really do, ranging in ages from 14 to 3. What a busy, potent little prick he must have."
More helpless howls, and by now I was howling right along with him. I'd caught it like the mumps.
"Kennedy is going to fax me pictures of the whole fam damnly."
We broke up completely, laughing together long distance. I could picture John Starrow sitting alone in his Park Avenue office, bellowing like a lunatic and scaring the cleaning ladies.
"That doesn't matter, though," he said when he could talk coherently again. "You see what matters, don't you?"
"Yes," I said. How could he be so stupid? Meaning Durgan, but also meaning DeVore. John understood, I think, that we were talking about both he's at the same time. "Elmer Durgan's a little lawyer from a little township tucked away in the big woods of western Maine, that's all. How could he know that some guardian angel would come along with the resources to smoke him out? He also bought a boat, by the way, 2 weeks ago. It's a twin outboard, a big un. It's over, Mike. The home team scores 9 runs in the bottom of the 9th, and the fucking pennant is ours."
"If you say so."
But my hand went off on its own expedition, making a loose fist and knocked on the good solid wood of the coffee table.
"And hey, the softball game wasn't a total loss."
John was still talking between little giggling outbursts like helium balloons.
"No, I'm taken with her."
"Her?"
"Maddie," he said patiently. "Maddie DeVore."
A pause, then,
"Mike, are you there?"
"Yeah," I said. "Phone slipped, sorry." The phone hadn't slipped as much as an inch, but it came out sounding natural enough, I thought. And if it hadn't, so what? When it came to Maddie, I would be, in John's mind at least, below suspicion, like the country house staff in an Agatha Christie. He was 28, maybe 30. The idea that a man 12 years older might be sexually attracted to Maddie had probably never crossed his mind, or maybe just for a second or two there on the common before he dismissed it as ludicrous. The way Maddie herself had dismissed the idea of Joe and the man in the brown sport coat.
"I can't do my courtship dance while I'm representing her," he said. "Wouldn't be ethical, wouldn't be safe either. Later, though, you never can tell."
"No," I said, hearing my voice as you sometimes do in moments when you are caught completely flat-footed, hearing it as though it were coming from someone else, someone on the radio or the record player, maybe. Are these the voices of our dead friends or just the gramophone? I thought of his hands, the fingers long and slender and without a ring on any of them, like Sarah's hands in that old photo. "No, you never can tell." We said goodbye, and I sat watching the muted baseball game. I thought about getting up to get a beer, but it seemed too far to the refrigerator, a safari, in fact. What I felt was a kind of dull hurt, followed by a better emotion, rueful relief, I guess you'd call it. Was he too old for her? No, I didn't think so, just about right. Prince Charming No. 2, this time in a 3-piece suit. Maddie's luck with men might finally be changing. And if so, I should be glad. I would be glad. And relieved. Because I had a book to write, and never mind the look of white sneakers flashing below a red sundress in the deepening gloom, or the ember of her cigarette dancing in the dark. Still, I felt really lonely for the first time since I saw Kyra marching up the white line of Route 68 in her bathing suit and flip-flops. "You funny little man," said Strickland, I told the empty room. It came out before I knew I was going to say anything. And when it did, the channel on the TV changed. It went from baseball to a rerun of All in the Family and then to Ren and Stimpy. I glanced down at the remote control. It was still on the coffee table where I'd left it. The TV channel changed again, and this time I was looking at Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. There was an airplane in the background, and I didn't need to pick up the remote and turn on the sound to know that Humphrey was telling Ingrid that she was getting on that plane. My wife's all-time favorite movie. She bawled at the end without fail. "Joe," I asked, "are you here?" Bunder's bell rang once, very faintly. There had been several presences in the house, I was sure of it. But tonight, for the first time, I was positive it was Joe who was with me. "Who was he, Hunt?" I asked. "The guy at the softball field. Who was he?" Bunter's bell hung still and quiet. She was in the room, though. I sensed her, something like a held breath. I remembered the ugly, jibing little message on the refrigerator after my dinner with Maddie and Kai. "Blue Rose Liar. Ha, ha, ha." "Who was he?" My voice was unsteady, sounding on the verge of tears. "What were you doing down here with some guy? Were you..." But I couldn't bring myself to ask if she had been lying to me, cheating on me. I couldn't ask, even though the presence I felt might be, let's face it, only in my own head. The TV switched away from Casablanca, and here was everybody's favorite lawyer, Perry Mason, on Nick at Night. Perry's nemesis, Hamilton Berger, was questioning a distraught-looking woman, and all at once the sound blared on, making me jump. "I am not a liar," some long-ago TV actress cried. For a moment, she looked right out at me, and I was stunned breathless to see Joe Noonan's eyes in that black-and-white 50s face. "I never lied, Mr. Berger, never." "I submit that you did," Berger responded. He moved in on her, leering like a vampire. "I submit that you..." The TV suddenly went off. Bunter's bell gave a single brisk shake, and then whatever had been here was gone. But I felt better. I am not a liar. I never lied, never. I could believe that if I chose to. If I chose. I went to bed, and there were no dreams. I had taken to starting work early, before the heat could really get a hold on the study. I'd drink some juice, gobble some toast, then sit behind the IBM until almost noon, watching the courier ball dance and twirl as the pages floated through the machine and came out with writing on them. That old magic, so strange and wonderful. It never really felt like work to me, although I called it that. It felt like some weird kind of mental trampoline I bounced on. Those were springs that took away all the weight of the world for a while. At noon I broke, drove down to Buddy Jellison's greasatorium for something nasty, then returned and worked for another hour or so. After that I would swim and take a long, dreamless nap in the north bedroom. I had barely poked my head into the master bedroom at the south end of the house, and if Mrs. M. thought this was odd, she kept it to herself. On Friday the 17th, I stopped at the Lakeview General on my way back to the house to gas up my Chevrolet. There are pumps at the all-purpose garage, and the go juice was a penny or two cheaper, but I didn't like the vibe. Today, as I stood in front of the store with the pump on automatic feed, looking off toward the mountains, Bill Dean's Dodge Ram pulled in on the other side of the island. He climbed down and gave me a smile. "How's it going, Mike?" "Pretty fair. Brenda says you're writing up a storm." "I am," I said, and it was on the tip of my tongue to ask for an update on the broken second-floor air conditioner. The tip of my tongue was where it stayed. I was still too nervous about my rediscovered ability to want to change anything about the environment in which I was doing it. Stupid, maybe, but sometimes things work just because you think they work. It's as good a definition of faith as any. "Well, I'm glad to hear it. Very glad."
I thought he was sincere enough, but he somehow didn't sound like Bill, not the one who had greeted me back, anyway. I've been looking up some old stuff about my side of the lake, I said. Sarah and the Red Tops? You always were sort of interested in them, if I remember. Them, yes, but not just them. Lots of history. I was talking to Mrs. M., and she told me about Normal Oster, Kenny's father. Bill's smile stayed on, and he only paused a moment in the act of unscrewing the cap on his gas tank, but I still had a sense, quite clear, that he had frozen inside. You wouldn't write about a thing like that, would you, Mike? Because there's a lot of people around here that'd feel bad and take it wrong. I told Joe the same thing.
Joe?
I felt an urge to step between the two pumps and over the island so I could grab him by the arm. What's Joe got to do with this? He looked at me cautiously and long. She didn't tell you?
What are you talking about?
She thought she might write something about Sarah and the Red Tops for one of the local papers. Bill was picking his words very slowly. I have a clear memory of that, and of how hot the sun was, beating down on my neck, and the sharpness of our shadows on the asphalt. He began to pump his gas, and the sound of the pump's motor was also very sharp. I think she even mentioned Yankee Magazine. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think I am. I was speechless. Why would she have kept quiet about the idea to try her hand at a little local history? Because she might have thought she was poaching on my territory? That was ridiculous. She had known me better than that, hadn't she? When did you have this conversation, Bill? Do you remember? "'Course I do," he said. "Same day she come down to take delivery of those plastic owls. Only I raised the subject because folks had told me she was asking around. Prying?" "I didn't say that," he said stiffly. "You did." "True, but I thought prying was what he meant. Go on." "Nothing to go on about. I told her there were sore toes here and there on the TR, same as there are any place, and asked her not to tread on any corns if she could help it. She said she understood. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. All I know is she kept on asking questions, listening to stories from old fools with more time than sense. When was this? Fall of 93, winter and spring of 94. Went all around town.